fault. It's right. It's right.
I'd like to call this meeting to order. Requirements of the Open Publics Meeting Act, PL 231, 1975, have been published in the Star Gazette and posted on the bulletin board at Borough Hall, stating the time, place, and purpose as required by law. You all please rise and join me in saluting our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
In the absence of our clerk, I guess we have to do Resolution 185-2011 first, which will be appointing Ms. Kilduff as our clerk for the evening.
Second.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions?
No, I guess you can officially do the roll call.
Here.
Here.
Donald?
Here.
Valentine?
Here.
William?
Here.
Doyle?
Here.
We're here for a training session with Mr. Dietz and his organization for our statewide insurance fund. I will turn the meeting over to you, sir.
Thank you, Mayor. All right, and council members, thanks for taking your time. I know everybody's schedule is just crazy these days, and storms that we've experienced recently certainly haven't helped.
If I can interrupt you just for a second, so everybody knows there's sandwiches over there and drinks.
Yeah, and water and drinks there, too, because you probably didn't have time to stop on the way home. But very well.
It's a W.
Yeah, it's not an M. It's a W. All right. A little over 2 years ago, I appeared before you all, and I was asking to be appointed as your insurance risk manager. You did that. You took that step, and one of the things I promised you was that, you know, we have a solid team there, that we have a lot of different expertise that really kind of is geared towards the municipal market. And with me tonight, I have Paul Messersmith. Paul's in charge. He's in charge of our liability department. He's probably about as close as you'll get to a Title 59 expert. Sits in many conferences, meets with attorneys, provides advice, and of course all of that expertise flows through to the town. John Whitley. John joined us a year ago, September. He was with a municipal group in New Jersey that oversees a lot of joint insurance funds. Brought 10 years of experience in that area with him. Annette Krauss, Annette is in our claims department, but again, following the path, Annette is a former deputy mayor, has sat on both sides of the counter here, so it's a and another 25 employees back at the shop who I would like to think, Rick, over the last couple of years have worked very hard. We work very hard for all our clients. That's, you know, that's what we do. That's who we are. Being responsive to questions, being responsive to, you know, whether it's an emergency certificate that needs to be issued, whatever the scope is. We're clear what our role is, and you're our client, and we're there for you. As a part of that, the Statewide Insurance Fund, which the Borough of Washington has been a member of, I want to say since 1994, they're one of the original, you're one of the charter members. I think it's been a very successful relationship. Statewide offers through their risk manager, they give us the opportunity to go out and present to council members key topics going, you know, from year to year. Last year was municipal ethics. This year it's about controlling costs, controlling liability and workers' compensation costs. And you're not going to be claims experts when this is over, but I think we've put together some interesting statistics that raises awareness. And that's what our goal is and our expectation is for tonight. Within your packet there is some claim information. It is confidential, I caution you on that, but it is obviously, I think, key to you. It really gives you a spread of what's been happening in the town. Where do injuries occur? Where have, you know, claims occurred? The numbers that are listed there are incurred loss. What that means is that's what's been paid on the claim, plus what might, if it's a closed claim, that's everything. If it's an open claim, it's paid plus what might be still in reserve. for that claim. Okay. Controlling workers' compensation liability costs. Everybody is under pressure. All councils, mayors, what have you, counties. Local tax rates capped at 2%. What do we do about our costs? $350 million a year in workers' comp and liability claims. Results? Claim costs will force even more cuts in local services. You all have had to make, I'm sure, some tough decisions over the last 2 to 3 years, and everybody's seeing it around town. Everybody's being asked to do a little more, maybe, you know, extra hours, work harder, work smarter. These, you know, unless we control these issues, the claim costs are going to force even more cuts in local services. What is the big hot spot in this area? Workers' compensation medical. It's just like your health care. The medical costs are rising well in excess of 2%. So how do we control those costs? We have to, you know, be safer. We have to be more attentive to the claims. Washington Borough has done an excellent job in that area. Since I met with you, and when I first asked you to become risk manager almost 3 years ago now, the claim awareness and the safety meetings in this town have borne fruit. People are, you know, they're thinking a little more about it. You know, we take the approach with the employee that our goal here, it's not about insurance costs. Our goal here is for you to come to work, do your day's work in a safe environment, and go home with all the parts that you came to work with. And it's working. It's doing, you know, I think you have a great management staff here. Christine, Rich, everybody chips in. They take it serious when we do our annual inspections. We come and we look at all the properties, safety inspections, just some of the training, PEOSHA training, hazard communication, personal protective equipment, confined space entry. These are all trainings that have been done over the last 2 years here. Lockout, tagout, fire extinguisher and emergency planning, highway work zone safety, bloodborne pathogen awareness, and the respiratory program. And in addition to that, an inspection is done both by our staff, and the fund has a safety expert that they send out to the town that goes through looking at different aspects of the training. Employee lost time accidents. The other half of the workers' compensation equation, you have the medical, then you have the lost time. The employee is injured, they're out of work, it's a disability type of coverage. Local government, per 100 employees, 4.3 cases are lost time. Below that, construction at 3.1, mining at 2.8, and finance and insurance at 0.3, which the interesting statistic here is miners have less of a chance of having a lost time accident than a municipal worker. And to some degree, it's the nature of the beast. You have, in this town, it's different, but typically you have police exposure. You have volunteer fire and EMS. You have just your DPW. I mean, I call those athletes. The DPW guys are athletes in industry because they're out there every day. They're doing the manual labor, and they're going to get muscle pulls. They're going to get strains from lifting. We try to teach them the right techniques and keep them safe within the job that they have to perform day to day. New Jersey local government claims, three departments account for 90% of the accidents. Anybody want to just take an educated guess which one's number one?
Police.
Police.
Road department.
Road. DPW. Anybody else? Public Works. Okay, you get an extra slice of sandwich. Second, police, and last but not least, our volunteer fire or paid fire and EMS. All right, that's what's driving it. Within your, I gave you some statistics unique to Washington Borough. Within your packet, there is a couple of pie charts that show both the number of claims by department as well for Washington Borough, and of course yours is no different than the national averages, and also number of claims per cause of what type of
incidents are causing those accidents. Workers' compensation costs continue to increase. Claim costs per full-time employee. 2005, which is not that long ago, $1,868. 2009, $2,520. Average per claim. A cost increase of 35% since 2005. Clearly we have a huge task in front of us as your risk manager, and the fund is working behind the scenes on the safety issues. But with a 2% cap in place, and last year the increase, the insurance increase for Washington Borough was 1.89%. It's going to be tough. It's going to be very difficult to make that this year. They're working diligently on it. Property losses, underwriters in insurance companies are funny animals. They tend to forget about the 10 years of great experience that you had, and you have a year with storms, and all of a sudden they need to make all their money back. So they're doing their best, but these are just, like I said, some of the numbers, and this is about awareness. Okay. More bad news, all right? Paul is our liability expert. I'm going to turn this over to him. I believe in this training. It's not meant to scare or intimidate anybody. It really is about awareness.
Thank you, Wayne. That was a great segue.
More bad news.
As I introduce myself, I'm Paul Messerschmidt. I've been in the insurance industry for over 30 years, almost all of it in the claims area, but some underwriting. That's why I get to give you the bad news, because I'm the one that sees all the claims, and I get to see what happens as a result of the claims. So one of the things I first wanted to show you, and we're going to pull all this together to show you why we're showing you statistics and then how to prevent these statistics from occurring here in the borough. There's certain court systems in the United States by state that some are more plaintiff-friendly, we call them. Others are more defendant-friendly. As you can probably imagine, New Jersey's up there in the top 10 somewhere. Any idea of what other states? You've probably heard large verdicts in other states in the United States. Some other states besides New Jersey?
California.
Do you remember the one out of California? The one everybody knows.
Well, off the top of my head, no, but I remember a big one.
It's the McDonald's case where the woman burned herself with the coffee. What people don't tell you is, in that case, the reason that she won so much money was McDonald's temperature of their coffee was 10 degrees hotter than everybody else's in the fast food industry. And they wanted to do that because they wanted their coffee to stay hot longer than everybody else's so that they could advertise that. And because of that, when it was sitting in between her legs when she was driving, it burned her because it was hotter and it scalded her leg. But anyway. California is one of the other ones. Have any other states that you've heard of that large verdicts?
New York
is also up there too. Texas is up there, believe it or not, and some of the southwestern states. Any idea where New Jersey falls with these other states? Anybody want to guess?
Up near the top.
Up near the top.
Very good.
Never
be there.
And it's right up there. I can work this. There we go. It is at the top, believe
number
it or not. New Jersey, and that's not what we want to be known for as number one, is that we have the most plaintiff-friendly court system in the United States. That's a little scary. And knowing that information, we realize what kind of verdicts come out of New Jersey, and it gets scarier each year because we continue to stay at number one. So what we're looking to do on both workers' comp but also on the liability is to try and move us down the list. And by doing that, we try to prevent claims rather than paying more money on claims. We did a 10-year study as to what the cost to the employer was. And in the year 2000, the cost to employers was $41 per employee. Look at what they have projected for 2011. Unbelievable, from $41 11 years later to $740 per employee.
Now, who does these
employment claims.
The state does this?
Oh, no, this is for the state, but they also do it by every state in the United States, but this is just for New Jersey. It's out of control. And we're talking about employment claims here. We're talking about employees that feel that they were wrongfully terminated or were not properly promoted. Whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. And you have to remember, these costs include defense costs, not just paying settlements. Because defense costs, as you're going to see in just a minute, is a big factor in these cases, and that's what's driven this number up so much. It's called legal fees and fee shifting cases. Anybody heard of fee shifting cases before? Okay. In employment claims, where an employee makes a claim against the employer, if the employee is awarded at least $1 in court, they are allowed to have all of their attorney's fees paid by the defendant. So if you fight a case where an employee sues the township, or I'm sorry, the borough, and you lose, you not only pay the employee, you pay their attorney or your insurance does. Think about that for a second.
That's if it goes to court, not out of court.
That's if it's the settlement out of court, we don't pay their attorney. Mm-hmm. Only if there is a verdict or an award. So what do we do? How do you prevent this? Well, one way is settle the case early. Unfortunately, and you may not be responsible. You may be right in every aspect of your case, but if you lose, and even if they're awarded $1, you pay all their attorney's fee cases. And if you look at the bottom of this, in a recent New Jersey case, the plaintiff received $20,000. Look what their plaintiff's attorney received.
Nice,
right? It's good to be a plaintiff's attorney in New Jersey.
It's out of control.
It's absolutely out of control. You're right. And we're going to talk about ways to fix this. There's ways that you can do it locally, and there's ways that we can do it up at the upper level where we change legislation.
Right.
And I'm going to let John talk with you about some of these solutions now.
Great. Thank you, Paul. I'm John Whitley. I've been with D&H, as Wayne said, for about a year now. So thank you for letting us come out tonight and present to you. Okay. As Paul mentioned, we're talking about some solutions. First, about changing the culture and following some proven results, setting up some best practices, managing the borough's claims and suits against them, and helping change the legislation.
Many of which are occurring in the borough right now. Many of these things are being employed right now to help control costs.
Thank you. First, we'll talk about changing culture in the field, which is preventing employee and public accidents. All municipal employees need to sign off on this, as well as changing the culture at work, preventing harassment and discrimination. And then finally, changing the culture in the courts and the legislature, which all administrative and legal need to really get behind to help change that. Can everyone hear me? I apologize. I'm having a little bug that I'm fighting, so my voice isn't really good. I want to talk about the PSE&G model. And what this is, it was the model that they adopted that really gave their employees a buy-in. And what I mean by that is it gave them empowerment. Up until the year 2000, PSE&G's accident and fatality rate was pretty level. After that, it started to drop dramatically. And why that was is because they adopted a model which gave their employees the empowerment to stop any job out in the field which they felt may be unsafe without any retaliation or anything against them. And what that did is, you know, that really gave the employees that buy-in. Not only look out for themselves, look out for their fellow employees from you know, any accidents, fatality. So, you know, municipalities, being a different animal, that can adopt, you know, some similar type of procedures where the employees can get into the buy-in, get more involved, really, you know, controlling things at the town level. Safety committees. Wayne mentioned before, the borough has a very active safety committee, is very aware. You know, you always want to rotate membership within the committee. Obviously, every employee should have the opportunity at least once in their career to sit on the committee, especially the younger employees when they get in. Get them involved early. it keeps them excited with that. The chairperson, excuse me, you want to rotate about every 2 years. Keeps things from getting stale, stagnant. And obviously you want to prepare the new chairperson coming in with proper training. And the functions of the safety committee, as you're aware, they report to the governing body, they audit and update training records for all of the employees, and they set up all the training for each year. Some of the reports they do provide monthly to the governing body are the stats, the minutes, claim status, and all accident investigation. Not only what happened, but what can be done to prevent from happening again. Look at this statement. The promise where supervisors and crew leaders discuss safety with employees each morning can reduce accidents by 54%. So if all your crew leaders and department heads take just a small amount of time each morning before they go out into the field just to discuss safety topics, you know, just a review for the day, a couple minutes each day can reduce your claims by about 50%. If you did that every day, that adds up, you know. And all of your supervisors should complete basic managerial risk management training. That is a must if you want to follow that. Now, police departments, as we know, they have the highest combined workers' compensation liability exposure as well. Of course, you know, they're in and out of cars, chasing suspects, high-speed chases, the list goes on. That's on the workers' comp side. On the liability side, of course, there's false arrest accusations, discrimination, etc. So how do we lower these exposures? I think Annette, you were going to speak on that. I'm going to jump ahead there. Thank you.
Now, we don't have the police department in our liability anymore, right?
Not in our liability, no, but we do some joint training with them.
Okay.
As Wayne introduced me before, my name's Annette Seaman, and I come with 12 years of elected official experience, and I was also the president of the Sussex County League of Municipalities while I was the president, while I was mayor. Okay, so for the police departments, it's recommended to do some type of accreditation program to keep them up to date with policies and procedural changes, and just so that they know what's going on in the latest changes among throughout the state. And you can find a lot of information through the New Jersey State Association of Chiefs of Police. So it will also help lower the claims if their procedures are all up to date as well, and with the police departments. And I know, like you said, you're combined with the township, correct? So, and then as well, your police department is also civil service, correct?
There it's not.
Okay. So do you know if they currently have some type of a management succession plan when it goes for promotions?
Off the top of my head, I don't
know. Okay, that's something that you want to look into, is to have that, because if you don't have it and there's a police officer that's been stepped over, that just opens up right away a claim for you, a liability claim, and a suit will come very quickly. So it's really important to keep up the succession plan in the promotion.
What is that, something that's done annually by...
It should be kept up annually, especially if there's turnover.
And who does that, the managers or the administrators?
On the administrative side, the chief probably would do it as well.
Oh, sure.
With that. The middle button? Oh, there it is. Okay, and then for the employment practices, anti-harassment and discrimination training for all employees. And I know Statewide has a... have they all been trained in that recently, Wayne?
I don't think it's been actually held because it's the last one. The most recent one was held in Springfield. I think it was a 2 day, they offered it 2 day morning and afternoon. And it's, and you know, we try to get the training here for you because the top to send two, three, you know, shorthanded as you are, send two or three employees down. But, you know, what we'll do is, and that's part of our responsibility, that you can fill those gaps and get the training done here. And the municipal attorney is also a good resource for that.
Mm-hmm. And then again, by keeping up the personnel policies and manuals, that's how you stay abreast of that. And then your policies and procedures for whistleblowing, there is, the Department of Labor does have a form that can be handed out to the employees. And then also advising your employees on the complaint procedure. You know, if you have the open communications and everything's explained to them, you're going to stay out of a lot of trouble that way. And then a lot of times it's, you know, for the non-civil service side, to retain an outside agency when doing interviewing candidates, because then you will be pushing that. So sometimes the easiest stuff is overlooked. So on the legislative changes, Paul is most well versed in the sick leave injury and the legal fee caps, and I know he touched a little bit on it before, but Paul will talk to you about that, those two.
On the sick leave injury, at the state level, they did away with this program for the employees, so they no longer could collect for sick leave when they were injured. However, they didn't do away with this at the local levels. You were cut out of it, so to speak. And that's one of the legislative changes that we're talking about in trying to get the legislators to change this at the local level so that the local government also can lower your workers' comp costs by cutting out this sick leave injury. And so that's one of the things that we're pushing is if the legislators can change this, that would help you tremendously on your workers' comp claim. And then, as we talked about before, with the fee-shifting cases, the legislators are working on instituting a legal fee cap. So, for instance, if the plaintiff is awarded $50,000 or less, the most that their attorney can collect is $50,000. Now, in these fee-shifting cases, a judge has to award these. They don't automatically get it. They have to present their bills to the judge. The judge reviews them to see if they're adequate. Unfortunately, where do the judges come from?
Legal profession.
Exactly. They're from the legal profession. So they don't usually find bills for $450,000 outrageous. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do. And there's actually a bunch of firms. There's a national company that I sat on their committee for New Jersey in Washington, D.C., that works at the grassroots level. They're working on this legal fee cap as well. So we're trying to get not just the local government working on this, but some of these larger companies that are involved in changing legislation. But if we can lower this legal fee cap on plaintiff's attorneys, we're not telling them they shouldn't get anything. We're just saying, you know what, you should get what's reasonable. This would also lower your employment case amounts tremendously, and that's where you're going to start seeing where your costs for your insurance will go down. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to lower your costs of insurance.
Is there pending legislation now, like bills that have been introduced? Do you know bill numbers?
There has been pending legislation on this for the last 10 years. It's unbelievable. And the problem is that the plaintiff's bar fights this and fights this, and they're a very strong organization. So we're trying to get more and more, not just defense attorneys, but also self-insured municipalities to band together to try and get a little bit stronger than they are.
Could you send our manager the bill numbers?
The bill numbers?
Yeah,
from I think we'll find them.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the other thing with the legislation, though. A lot of the state's elected officials are also in the legal, coming out of the legal profession, so kind of, I think they all just are holding it all up in legislation, not pushing through the bill.
Right.
But if we get enough municipalities pushing it, you know, they're going to have to start listening. So,
if we had the bill numbers, we could know who was sponsoring it.
Absolutely. We can get that for you.
Yeah, we'll get that for you.
So these are just two of the things that we're saying from the legislative side that maybe we can help lower your costs. And you can help yourselves with lowering these costs.
Thanks, Paul.
Sure.
And then we have the sidewalk liability. Right now, a homeowner, if someone trips and falls, is responsible. Even if you have a local ordinance that says they would not be responsible in the court system, it would fall in favor of the injured party. Business owners, though, are right now relieved from it. So there's been discussion of removing sidewalks from being part of public property, and therefore it would fall on the homeowners if they're not maintaining their sidewalks properly. So that's another, we see a lot of claims come through with residents walking their dogs, they're just out for a walk and tripping and falling.
Trips.
Yep.
So why is the municipality then stuck with it if it's the homeowner's responsibility?
Well, right now, that's how the legislation reads.
What, that it's the municipality's responsibility, not the homeowner?
Correct.
Oh, okay, so
but if the homeowner's responsibility, it should be the homeowner's responsibility to maintain the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
Which also includes snow and ice removal, just not construction items, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And that, you said that also affects businesses as well?
Businesses have, business owners are immune, they have to be responsible for it.
They are responsible.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the homeowners aren't.
There's been court cases in New Jersey over the last 5 years where commercial establishments have been found that they're responsible for the sidewalk, even though the municipality may have put it in and may have repaired it. The business owner is still responsible because they're drawing people in to their business. But right now, the residents, even though you may have an ordinance that says that the resident is responsible for cleaning the sidewalk and even possibly repairing the sidewalk, in the court system, they're saying that's not fair. The resident should be responsible anytime somebody falls down. So who's the responsibility fall on, unfortunately? They're trying to change that in the legislature as well to include that where it's a fall in front of a private resident, it's the same as a fall in front of a commercial establishment.
So how far did the appeals go? Did it go to the state Supreme Court?
The appeal of what, the court cases?
Yeah.
The court cases, they'll start out in the law division. If the plaintiff loses in the case, or if either side loses, they can appeal to the appellate division.
Yeah.
The appellate division typically will only hear the case if there's conflicting decisions in the law division. And then if you get past, if you're not happy with the appellate division, you can take it to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court typically is not going to take something.
Well, what I was asking was basically how far has, are you aware, has
that
at least gone?
They don't go to the appellate level. The Supreme Court is interested in more cerebral things than this, unfortunately.
But if the sidewalk liability falls back onto the resident,
mm-hmm.
So then we would have to change our ordinances. We couldn't enforce the keeping sidewalks free of snow if it's the resident's responsibility for claims, right? You have to go and change all your ordinances then?
Well, if your ordinance currently says that a resident is responsible for the sidewalk,
right.
You want to keep that in place.
So how can you enforce it if it's not the town sidewalk?
Well, here's the thing.
You can enforce it.
Well, it's still the town sidewalk. It's just that the person living adjacent to it is responsible for its upkeep. Even
the upkeep,
don't
but now if somebody gets hurt on that, let's say you said then the homeowner is responsible for all those claims against that, for that injury,
that's
not
correct.
The town.
That's correct.
It would go through the homeowner's power.
Because they were maintaining it.
Right now,
that's dumb.
Right now, it's the municipality's responsibility. And here's the thing. You have a local ordinance. Most municipalities have a local ordinance that says the adjacent property owner, doesn't matter whether it's a resident or a business, is responsible for the sidewalk,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can fine somebody for if they don't do that,
right.
If they don't keep it up. But yet, that's as far as it goes. If somebody falls down, you're still responsible.
The municipality at this
that's
point.
Correct.
Right. But if it
and
changes.
That's right. And they're trying to change it to say, now, I mean, let's face it, there's homeowners that can't afford to keep that sidewalk up in front of their house. They have to look for other means to get that sidewalk taken care of it. Whether it's a homeowners association, a block association, that they pull together and do something like that. But essentially, they're trying to change it so that the municipality isn't always responsible because the municipality doesn't have the funds to keep the sidewalks in pristine shape. You walk in any municipality in the state of New Jersey, you walk along the sidewalks, they don't have pristine sidewalks everywhere in the municipality. They can't afford to do it. They don't have the budget and they don't have the manpower to do it. That's why they're trying to change it, because as you cut back on your staff and the funds that you have to fix this, you need some insulation for that as to being sued.
Probably never pass because
you're
not going to get much money out of a resident.
That's right.
If they were state sidewalks, people would sue them left and left.
Absolutely.
And then there's the weather immunity. They're looking to change it from solely a weather condition to primarily, and it's solely right now with the snow and removal of snow, and they want to change that because at times there are some weather conditions that the municipalities have no control over. So that's another one before the legislative. And then the boardwalk immunity doesn't apply to us because we don't have boardwalks. So the key here, with these, we'll get you bill numbers that are out there, and if you can bring them to your state legislators and even to your league meetings in the county here. And I know in Sussex County, we were very successful several times with getting our state legislators to listen to us and push bills down there. So it's really key to get that going, especially with the first two that Paul discussed, because that's a huge hit on the municipalities with those fees.
Is there professional lobby groups, especially for the fee shifting, that are behind us?
The group that I was with is AIA, American Insurance Association, based out of Washington, D.C. And then they have local organizations under AIA in each state that handle each state. So that's just one. There's also, I think, PIA, professional insurance agents, also have lobbyists as well that fund this or try to help fund this.
And Wayne, would you like to come up and summarize for us?
Yeah, sure will. Okay, thank you guys. That's an excellent job. I'm just going to summarize this for you, and it's not all doom and gloom. This is about you being educated and conversant on what the issues are and what we can and can't do about it. Some of the things we've talked about tonight are no small task. There are groups on the other side lobbying just as hard the other way. So we've got our work cut out for us. But let's talk about Washington Borough for a second, changing the culture. I remember the first safety committee that I came to right after I was appointed, and I think two people showed up. And the last meeting that I went to here, every department was represented. Everybody was up to date on their claims. They knew what had happened. We discussed how it happened. We discussed what was done to prevent it. Active management. I mean, the change has been excellent. So there's clearly been a change in culture here. Employment practices, whistleblower, making it, what the rights are available and posting it and having open discussion about it. Again, something that I've had discussions with folks here on being done. Legislative changes, probably the toughest lift of all of this is getting change in Trenton, so imagine what it's like to get change in Washington. But
D.C. or N.J.?
Washington, D.C. <D.C. laughs> Okay. No comment. On the other, but since you gave me the opportunity in my company to come here, there have been some real positive changes, and the numbers, part of it's luck, knock on wood, part of it is just good management. But you're spending less money on claims, and the bottom line, what does that mean? We have more money for things that we really need and that are more important to the borough. You guys took some extra time out of your meeting time tonight. The statewide insurance fund provides a $250 per attendee reimbursement directly to the borough, which, we'll turn this into them that you've completed your training, and that'll come back to you folks. So it's not to be all and end all. It's really about getting you here and being able to talk to you and train you. But there is a little incentive that they throw in as well. Believe it or not, not that many towns, not nearly enough towns, take advantage of that. And out of probably the 70 members, probably somewhere between 10 and 20% actually take advantage. So give yourselves a pat on the back, too, for taking the time out. I appreciate your letting us come before you. And we'll open. We have a little bit of time left, so we'll open to questions if you have any from myself or any of our staff.
Any questions at all?
They're stunned by the numbers.
Yes.
I was just happy to hear the summary was encouraging. Good job on all parts on that. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
If I might also interject, there's been a couple of times where Wayne and I have talked directly with Rich when something came up here. And Rich uses us as his resource when something comes up that he's not sure, is the insurance going to cover this, or what's the best way to handle this so that the insurance does cover it, or anything like that.
Or so just what should I say to the party?
Communication with Rich on this in the past.
They're approaching me on this. What should I say? What shouldn't I say? This type of thing. And
right.
And it, the
the best, the cheapest claim is the one that's prevented. The next best claim is the one where control is taken early on. And just by virtue of you folks being here, you know, you're aware. You're kind of in control of your situation, right? And that's step one.
Mr. Torres.
Yeah, I have a question. Mm-hmm. You gave us nice figures, and we could see that there's definite improvement over the years, especially in Washington Borough here. But how does this compare? I'm sure you're privy to, like, the other municipalities throughout the state. Where do we fall in with our numbers?
I would say you're in the top 10%.
Of what?
Claims or
of
your member companies within the fund.
Meaning that we're lower?
The
or
the other municipalities. So you're in the top 10%.
Okay.
Yeah, you're in the top 10%. And it wasn't always that way. Like you said, it's progressed. You were always in the top half, but you've progressed.
Yes, getting back to the SLI, let's say an employee was hired, it was offered at the time when they were hired. Now you maybe take that away, like it would lower costs. Would that be retroactive when they were hired, or would that be taken away immediately? That would not be available any longer to that employee.
My understanding is it's immediate.
It's immediate.
Yeah.
It's not retroactive.
Yeah.
Like if it was something they were hired with, they're entitled to until they're retired.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
That's the way they did it at
okay.
the state level.
Okay.
So I would assume that would be the same at the local.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have.
Okay. Anything else?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in.
And like I said, we're always a resource. We don't run the doorstep down, but if you need us, we're here.
Okay.
There's also some light refreshments here.
Thank you.
I would accept a motion for a recess until 7:30.
Thank you.
For a second?
Second.
Pleasure. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you.
All
right, convene the meeting. Next up on our agenda, we have the council appearance by the Highlands Council. We have Ms. Eileen Swan. Start off with you, I guess. If I may, just for a second, I'll give you a little of the impetus behind this. With the code book being redone and everything, it's going to not necessarily require, but it would be a good idea to get the master plan reviewed again.
Okay.
It would be a good idea to get the master plan reviewed again. We've invited the Highlands Council out because if we are involved with the Highlands Council, as long as it complies, the master plan will comply with some Highlands regulations, they will pay for it. And we're looking at approximately $45,000 to $50,000 for a master plan review, so we've invited Ms. Swan back again to present for us.
And if I could, before you continue, what prompted this was we had a meeting at the planning board, and this was discussed, and the planning board asked me, because I'm the liaison, to bring this before the council again, and we got an email from Bill Gleba, who's our engineer, and the final, he talks about the fact of the things that Mayor Scott McDonald just said, and his closing paragraph is, lastly, I would be remiss and would like to again emphasize that if the borough was a participant in the Highlands performance process, some and possibly all of these costs for the master plan re-exam, riparian buffer ordinances, steep slope and land development zoning ordinances, modification revisions could be covered by Highland grant monies, saving the taxpayers of the borough a reasonable amount of money.
Okay, come down here so I can see your presentation.
Okay, I'm going to, is this working?
No.
Oh, it's just for recording, is it? But I'm pretty loud. If you can't hear me, let me know, but I'm pretty loud. Yeah, you're very welcome. And if there's one thing hopefully everybody will agree with when I leave, it's that I was loud. Thanks, it's not the first time I've heard that either. Well, I'd like to thank the mayor and the council for inviting us here this evening, and Rich, we've had a couple of emails and phone conversations. What I really want to do is bring you up to date on where we are in the process of plan conformance with the Highlands Regional Master Plan and tell you what it really means for Washington Borough. What I'd like you to do is put everything out of your head that you've heard, because hopefully what we'll do this evening is show you where we are and what the facts are. And Tom Borden is the chief counsel, so that's the top legal person at the Highlands Council, and he's the deputy executive director. I'm the executive director. We're happy to stay here tonight and answer all your questions as well. So the cover here is the cover of our regional master plan, which was adopted in 2008. The Highlands Act was signed in 2004. We'll begin by giving you a little look back, and it would be wonderful if that worked, but it's not going to. Okay, we're going to... Okay. Great. A quick look here at the entire Highlands region. It's a federal region, and it stretches from Pennsylvania into New York, New Jersey, New York, and up into Connecticut. It was recognized by the Federal Highlands Conservation Act and signed into law by President Bush. And that law provides some money for conservation for the entire federal Highlands region. But it gives you an idea of the importance of the region from a nationwide perspective. From the New Jersey perspective, you see the Highlands up in the two shades of green up in the north area there of the state. And all those other areas that are shown in blues and purples get some or all of their water from the Highlands. And this is the reason why the legislature felt it was important in 2004 to protect the area, because though it's only 17% of the land base of the state of New Jersey, it provides water for over half the population. So some 5.4 million residents rely on this region for their water. The residents of the region primarily get their water from groundwater wells. Those outside the region get it from surface water from reservoirs. So all those businesses in those areas as well, which drive the economy of the state, are relying on the water from the Highlands. I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that from the very outset, the Highlands Council, which was formed by the Act, has supported a water user fee for those residents outside of the region who get their water from the region, because as a matter of fairness, they gain benefit from the protection of their water. And so if they paid a small fee, it would teach them how to conserve water better, because it's a good reminder, and that money could come back into the area to help protect the water for all of us, them and us. There was a bill put into place by Senator Smith, but it has yet to get out of committee and be voted on. And honestly, in these economic times, I think the governor has been very clear that he's not going to have any additional costs. Senator Bob Smith. He's not one of the legislators from this area.
He's not
ours. No, he's not yours. Okay, and this is the region that was, in the 2004 Highlands Act, became the Highlands region of New Jersey. It's part of seven counties. It's all of 88 municipalities. And the area is then divided into two very distinct areas. The dark green that you see there is known as the preservation area. Those municipalities that have any lands in the preservation area must conform for those lands and then have a decision to make about their planning area lands. The yellow you see now is the planning area, and you fall within the planning area. So it's entirely up to you whether you want to conform to the Highlands Regional Master Plan or not. So what's critical then is to figure out what does it mean to you, because it means very different things to different municipalities. Here's a look at land use cover change in the Highlands region of New Jersey from 1972 through to 2007. So what you're watching is the growth of that red color. That's what's known as urban development. It's basically just development, increased impervious surface. If you look at it, you can see how it just sort of sprawls out across the region. And it's that sprawl type growth which really prevents protection of the environment and protection of water resources. The ideal is, frankly, to grow in areas like Washington Borough and to protect your environs, not to grow out into the farmlands, the steep slopes, the forested areas. If you protect those, you protect your water resources. But Washington Borough is primarily a developed area, and those are the economic drivers for the region. Places like Hackettstown, like Phillipsburg, like Oxford, like Washington Borough. So where are we in the process? The plan, as I told you, was put into place in 2008. We had been out to Washington Borough in the past and other municipalities talking about the process of drafting a plan, and people were really focused on the DEP Highlands rules, which only ever apply in the preservation area. So importantly, if the borough did decide to conform, you don't conform to the DEP Highlands rules. Your DEP rules would be the same as anywhere else in the state of New Jersey. what you're conforming to is the Highlands Regional Master Plan, which is a very different document to those DEP rules. The 88 municipalities, about half the area have to conform. Currently, we have 60 of the 88 municipalities have submitted petitions to conform. That's much more than a notice of intent, which was in the past when towns were exploring it. They used an initial assessment grant to explore it, as did Washington Borough at the time. But subsequent to that, if a municipality wants to move forward and petition us, that's the next step. 60 towns have done that. It represents 97% conformance in the preservation area. Only one municipality that is mandated to conform has not. And our attitude to that is we'll wait and see. Hopefully in time they'll come in. But all of the municipalities bar one are in. In terms of the planning area, already more than one-third of the planning area has petitioned for conformance. And to date, the Highlands Council has approved 33 of the 60 petitions for plan conformance, which means that 33 towns have taken that step. They've gotten the council, Highlands Council approval, and they're working with us to change their master plans, change their ordinances, their local regulations, to conform to the regional master plan. Quick look at those petitions that have submitted. 60 municipalities, 5 counties, 33 approved. If you look there at the townships that have been approved to date, so they're well advanced, Bethlehem, Byram, Chester, Denville, Franklin and Warren, Green, Hardyston, Holland, Lebanon, Lopatcong, Morwell, Mount Olive, Oxford, Pohatcong, Rockaway, Sparta, Tewkesbury, Washington and Morris, and West Milford. And then you can see the boroughs, Alpha, Bloomsbury, Bloomingdale, Califon, Glengardner, Hampton, Highbridge, Kinlon, Lebanon, Ringwood and Wharton. 3 towns, Clinton, Hackettstown and Phillipsburg, and 2 counties, Passaic and Somerset. Originally, when we got petitions, many of the towns petitioned only for their preservation area lands. That would be towns like Oxford, like Hackettstown. Subsequent to that, they asked us to include their planning area lands in their conformance. And just like your council cares about the constituents of your municipality, so too do those mayors care about their municipality and their constituents. So obviously they judge the regional master plan to see, is it better for their constituents to conform? They made that decision. So they then changed their petitions to include the their planning area lands. What you're looking at now is a map that shows the green is the preservation area. When they conform, they change to dark blue. The yellow are planning areas that have given us petitions. Where you see pale blue, it is where planning area lands have chosen to conform. So you see here, you see a little pale blue here, that must be, that's a split municipality. Byram here, split municipality, again a split municipality here, Chester. So what I want to do is show you from December 16th, I'll go through this quickly, and what you'll see is that each of the monthly meetings of the council, they're approving different towns that have chosen to work with us if they're in the pale blue, and that are obliged to if they're in the darker blue. But it shows the process up until October 13th, so that's what the map looks like today. So you can see quite a bit of the pale blue, and down at the southern tip there you see Alpha, Lopatcong, Phillipsburg, places like that that have decided to work with us in their planning area lands. So now a quick look at Washington Borough. The office has been shut for a couple of days, our office, because we've no power, no heat. Normally we'd get our staff to come out here and take a couple of pictures. This time we stole them. They're all from your site. Thank you very much. But we would have liked to have come out ourselves. But you have 1,259 acres entirely within the planning area. So your future with us is yours to decide. Municipalities in the planning area can choose to conform with the regional master plan at any time or at no time. Having a look at how we've seen your borough. Now, we've done the best we can with the information we have at a regional scale. Part of the work we do with municipalities is to get our information verified, but we pay the municipalities' professionals to verify the information. So in other words, when we used to have COA, Council on Affordable Housing, they did a vacant land analysis. They told you how many units you could build. Most municipalities certainly didn't agree with the analysis and called into question how it was done. We were required under the Highlands Act to do a similar exercise to see what vacant lands exist and what was the capacity for growth, often based on sewer and water. What we did is we did the analysis, and then we shared the information with all the municipalities, and we paid for their engineers and their planners to look at that information and even staff within the municipality and verify it. Tell us where we got it wrong, make sure we got it right. Now, it's sort of an iterative process. Most of the towns have gone through that process and corrected it. In fact, we did do a build-out with Washington Borough. Don't believe it was ever fully completed. But what it means is when we say we've got a vacant land analysis, you have verified it. So no longer, you've corrected our information, basically. So we do all our work in that way. We don't dictate, because dictating often gets you into a lot of trouble. We partner with municipalities to make sure we've got the information correct. This map shows you, in our mapping of the area, we were required to do a capacity analysis and a capability zone. So what we did is we divided the area into roughly three primary zones, exactly three primary zones. Protection zone, which is the area where we would not really encourage development. Generally speaking, it's either forested, steep slopes, whatever. The only area here in Washington that we see in that area is down here, this area of the town. The rest of the town is what we call existing community. It means a level of development has occurred. So what we think would happen in a place like Washington Borough is opportunities for redevelopment. This is wellhead protection areas. All this does is gives you information in terms of protection of, you know, what goes into the ground, because you want to protect your wells. Here we see some historic information from the State Historic Preservation Office. And again, this is just opportunities when we're working with towns. Towns want to protect the character of those kind of areas, and we assist them in that kind of planning. And in fact, in the past, we did give a grant to Washington Borough. You worked with your planners and did planning on redevelopment and historic preservation. That was a grant of $52,000. So you have that work already done. So it's work you can continue to draw from. Washington Township in Morris County, for example, has established a center with us, a development area, which includes an area along 513 where they want to have municipal facilities and some housing down there. And then they included a historic area that they want to focus on for redevelopment opportunities, making sure that they maintain the historic character. That's just another example of a town working with us. This is a very important map, and this really dictates how we see you. This basically shows us where you have water and sewer. And this is very unlike other areas that we work with. You are, by definition, a center. And in the past, you had a joint center with Washington Township. Unfortunately, all centers under the state plan have expired because they had a 10-year lifespan. We designate centers through our planning. They don't expire. As far as we're concerned, they never disappear. They don't dissolve into thin air. And it's sort of a waste of money having to do things to get them back up again. I mean, they're there. But what the designation process is a recognition that it's a center, a recognition for the state to understand that when there is money for infrastructure and support, it should go to those areas first. That's where you really need to focus state dollars. So in terms of Washington Borough, we would see the entire borough as a center. You can have protections for those areas, that area down in the south that you saw where you've got your steep slopes and forested areas and wetlands is the reason why it hasn't been developed to date. The rest of the town, we see opportunities just for redevelopment, that kind of work. So we would follow the outline of the town. The focus of the center would be to continue the revitalization we've seen in Washington Borough, take advantage of your small town character, your historic character, looking at the stream banks, etc., as opportunities again for revitalizing the town and using those to enhance the town. So it's really about sustainable economic development. This is, just to show you, this is Phillipsburg. And we took the same approach for Phillipsburg, where the entire area of Phillipsburg, even along the Delaware, is seen as a center. There are two areas shown on this map. Here along the Delaware, and over here a site that you may know, it's called Ingersoll Rand site. It used to be a huge employment facility for them, and it's now basically nothing. Brownfield, thank you, madam. And Lopatcong is this little portion of it here. We see those as redevelopment areas, and the town has recognized them as such, and we're assisting them with planning for those, for the revitalization of those areas. This is up to date. These are the centres we've designated today, up to date, to today. The Township of Pohatcong, the Town of Phillipsburg, the Borough of Alpha, the Township of Washington Morris County, the Town of Hackettstown, the Borough of Wharton, the Township of Byram, and the Township of Oxford. Now, that's not to say in each of these cases it's the entirety of the municipality. In the case of Byram, it's a small area along Route 206. But if you know Byram, it's hills and lakes, and it's known as the Township of Lakes. So obviously it wouldn't be appropriate to have the whole thing designated a center. Phillipsburg was the first one where we did the entire center. It made sense. That's what Phillipsburg looks like to us today, and we see it again as an opportunity for redevelopment and to be an economic driver for the for this region. And that's how we see Washington Borough. So what your mayor brought up was the concept of funding. We have been fortunate in that we had funding put aside through the Highlands Act. The funding comes from the realty transfer fee. Automatically, every year, some of those funds are set aside for the Highlands. And the Highlands Council directly gets those funds, which can only be used for counties and municipalities that work with us through the plan conformance process. The law is very clear. It is for the reasonable costs associated with plan conformance. So what we do is we make grant funding available. We've done so in the past. We've given you some grants. Under the plan conformance grant, we set forth the studies that have to be done. And each town, then we also set forth the amounts. The towns have to manage those funds to make sure that everything gets done within the stipulated amounts. But we're doing that across the region, working currently with 33 towns that have moved through the process and have what we call our amended grant agreements. These are the kind of funding that we would supply to Washington Borough. Funds for a Highland Center designation. Now, we'd be looking at a master plan element that would look at a center and the kind of master planning you want in a center. Redevelopment area planning. There may be areas within the borough that you want to focus on. We don't dictate, because you know your municipality best, and you know those areas that you should focus on first. So you have to sort of prioritize things. Sustainable economic development planning. Having a plan moving forward to stay sustainable, what kind of business to bring in. We've done that kind of planning. Highbridge, for example, started looking at that with us some time ago, and they've actually done their first sustainable economic development plan with us. Historic preservation plan. Now, we know you've done some of this work, but this is to build on it and move forward with it. Water use and conservation management plan is something we supply the funding for, but we take lead on that. And what we're doing is we're working at the moment, and you're actually one of the pilot towns we're working with. So we're looking at the kind of ways municipalities can better conserve water. It's going to be different planning depending on the different town, because obviously it's going to be very different in an agricultural community to what it's going to be in a downtown like yourselves. What we'll do is we'll provide a model with a suite of different opportunities and work with the municipality to adopt a plan. Wastewater management planning, it is important, but it's not important for you guys because you know where you are with your wastewater, you know what's served. But certainly we could look at issues of capacity, because if you're talking about future growth, you have to figure out, do you have the capacity, and we can work with you on things like that. Stream corridor protection restoration plan. Again, any downtown area that has streams, water in it, wants to make sure that those are used to best enhance those economic viabilities. We don't say, if you're developed up to the stream bank, we don't say you have to rip it all up. Of course, we look at whenever there's more redevelopment opportunities, looking at the best engineering to better protect the streams. But certainly we see it as an integral part of your economic planning and the character of the community. So those are the kind of things we will assist with funding. So that's pretty much where we are to date. The one thing I want to just sort of get out of the way, a couple of things. Often residents will be concerned, I've been living here all my life, I have a house in Washington Borough. if my municipality chooses to conform with the Highlands Council, am I going to have to deal with you people in Chester, that's where we are, if I want to put an addition on my home? The answer is no. It's considered exempt. If it was built in prior to the Act 2004, it's exempt. All that controls it are your local regulations. All that were, they'll continue to control it. If you have a downtown business and you want to do more redevelopment, that's why we do a center, because we say this is the area where you should have redevelopment opportunities. So we assist in that kind of work. Those are the main things that people are concerned about when they're looking at the Highlands. But what I'd like to do now is turn it over to you and have you ask questions, and then, Mayor, if you want to hand it over to the public to ask us questions,
sure.
We'll both be very glad to answer.
Thank you. I'll first open it up to, I guess, Mr. Boyle.
Thank
Mr.
You,
Jewell, I can't see you, so you holler out if you have something. Go ahead, Mr. Boyle.
The last statement you made about a borough resident saying, how is this going to affect me if I'm going to put a deck? And the answer is no. Now, there's always an asterisk with an answer. Provided, you said about it was built prior to this. What was built? The home? The deck?
No, the entire
home. Yeah, there's 17 exemptions built into the Highlands Act. What that means is anything that fits within one of the 17 exemptions is exempt from the master plan and exempt from any ordinance you adopt to conform.
Okay.
So what that means practically is the law specifies that if a single family dwelling was existing on the date of the Act, August of 2004, any addition to that single family dwelling is exempt.
Forever.
After 2004? I mean, when you say the house was built in 2004, there's 17 exemptions or whatever.
Correct.
So you have to go down the checklist to see to make sure.
See which one you fall under.
So it's really not a clear cut and dry no. There's no but provided you fall into these 17.
Yeah, I mean, this is exemption number 5, which says...
I mean, that's what I'm asking.
It's clear cut, though.
It's clear cut.
But there's still stipulations involved.
No.
If it was built in 2005.
If it was built in 2005, what we built into our ordinance was an exclusion so that house would not be subject to the ordinance as well. So the bottom line is all single families, either if they're built or even vacant land that was zoned for single family, is exempt. What the legislature did was they were worried about larger developments, larger open lands and subdivision of lands as opposed to single family dwellings. So the law is explicitly clear and explicitly not full of conditions that single family dwellings are exempt.
No asterisks,
no conditions, no nothing.
So what about multifamily dwellings?
There's a separate exemption for that that allows a quarter acre increase of the impervious cover on that site, which usually will allow for that type of development. So the bottom line is if you have a developed footprint, you're going to be able to utilize that developed footprint under an exemption.
With no restrictions. Whatsoever.
Correct. And what Eileen alluded to before was the portion of the borough that's now vacant and in our protection zone is the primary portion of the borough that would be affected.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how we commonly refer to as the Baker Tract in our area.
Understood.
I have about two questions. First question is, if you can explain how this works, if a borough homeowner owns, say, an acre or so, has an existing structure prior to 2004, but decides they want to build an outbuilding or a garage on that same property. I've heard cases in the past that was not allowed and could not build something like that.
No, that goes back to that exemption.
They built the building after 2004.
They're allowed to, under that exemption, they're allowed to do any addition, any driveways, new decks, new garages for a single family. No, there's no limitation on it.
The problem, where the confusion is people are confusing it with the DEP regulations which apply in the preservation area. Then we might be saying, like a little asterisk, like if you hit a permit, you've got this. You're the planning area, so it's only the regional master plan. And we use the Act for those buildings that were built prior to 2004, and then it's basically time of decision, municipal land use law, for those subsequent to 2004. And that's how you get the what we call the exclusion. But there aren't, I know what you're concerned about, and so, no, those problems they're not going to be a concern for you.
And the second question is, too, if a homeowner owns a large sum of land, that he may be able to, down the road, decide he wants to sell or retire off of, and he wants to sell to the developer. Maybe put a subdivision in. Here, that could be a problem.
It depends on our overlay zone. As Eileen alluded to, the vast majority of the borough is in our, what's called our existing community zone, where we encourage development, redevelopment. So the only portion that we want to make very clear up front that
right.
we saw as resource constrained was the Baker tract.
Right. And with someone who knows that, they want to sell for development, maybe put a few cluster houses up there or whatnot. And my concern is, if they can't sell it to the developer, and if their land, they own it, basically you're telling them what to do with it, and they're limited to who they can sell it to, and what the market value that goes down that land. That's what I'm concerned about with the residents. They decide later on they want to sell, maybe retire on it.
Right. And I think
market value for that, and that's not getting a full price.
And I think
whatever
with
you make offer them, counter offer them for a price may not be.
So we're talking about this area here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was asking why.
Well, there are several areas in town that are large areas.
Everything else is existing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why we're saying everywhere else we're not having that.
Okay.
The issue is here because
right.
it does fall within our protection zone.
Right.
And I think it's because of the actual underlying conditions on the ground on the land there which have prevented it from being
right.
developed to date.
Right.
So if there is potential there, that's the one thing you could look at before you make any decision. Other than that, the rest of the town is existing community. We would, and we're terming it a center to encourage development and redevelopment, not to prohibit it.
But I'm concerned about what the price you're going to offer that homeowner to buy that land to preserve it as opposed to the market value. That's
well, in the majority of the borough, there's not a goal for land preservation. In the borough.
I'm not talking about the majority of the borough. I'm talking about that.
Oh, in that tract, you know, there, what you'd have to do is a site-specific analysis.
Right.
What the Highlands Act provided for participation in the Green Acres program, as an example,
right.
is the legislature created what's called a dual appraisal method. So they look at pre-Highlands Act development potential. What you'd be looking at, and I know there's wetlands on that site and
right.
steep slopes, so first you'd look at the environmental resources to see what pre-existing state laws would have limited, and then two appraisals are done, and the higher of the two is the formation of the basis for the negotiation. So the Highlands Act built in this equity provision to have pre-Highlands Act value be built into
right.
the appraisal process.
That's not guaranteed to match the market value.
Well, the market value, what the legislature was trying to do is try to find what was buildable pre-Highlands Act. So
right.
there they're giving that landowner the very much the benefit of the doubt.
Anything else, Mr. Jewell?
Okay.
And Mr. Higgins?
How long does a master plan, a municipal master plan, have to be redone?
Well, right now it's 10 years.
Do you know when the last time March was done?
2007, I believe it was.
Okay, so we're looking at about 100 years. So we want to get you guys in here to redo it.
Well, we're not
yeah.
going to redo it. You're going to redo it with your professionals.
But they'll provide the funds.
Absolutely.
What if it costs more than your grant?
This is one. We work with 60 municipalities. We have on staff a team of professional planners, engineers, scientists, etc. We give municipalities base amounts. I was a mayor in my town, just
mm-hmm.
down the road in Lebanon Township. I will tell you that when we give you a scope, you work with your professionals within that scope. You dictate to your professionals. I mean, I know how you mind your own money. I know how I did it as a mayor. If I'm dealing with my professionals, if this is the amount, this is the job, can you do it? If not, I can always ask a few more professionals to come in and bid on a job. But we are strict to stay within the amounts. But the amounts, we're getting the work done in other towns. And in fact, what some of the towns have done is if they've stayed under the amount, they've asked can they transfer that amount to another task. Now they have to get the authority from the council. But that's the way we've been working it today. So, for example, Highbridge has managed to, there's a bunch of other towns that have done that, have been able to save on some tasks. But I will tell you that it has to be managed. You know that dealing with your professionals. You manage the money. You don't say to the client, sorry, the consultant, you know, have at it and let us know what it costs.
Okay,
yeah.
Let me give you a for example.
Sure.
What you guys don't pay for or third time?
Well, we actually gave you a grant towards your COA cost, yeah.
Right, $25,000. We got a not-to-exceed contract with the people who did it. You remember that? And at the end, they wanted an additional $12,000 because it was more involved than they thought. Now, how do we prevent that?
You've got a contract. They're under contract for $25,000.
Thank you. You're getting $25,000. That's a very serious...
Oh, wait a second. All right, here's the problem that came into it. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is the state required more information after they had given us that not to exceed contract that required additional information that they weren't... The rules changed, kind of.
We do know what you're talking about.
And who was on the hook for the 12-5? We were.
The town.
So how do we prevent that from happening in the future?
Well, what we do is we'll work with you for a scope. Now, for the COA, that wasn't our obligation. But we do support affordable housing, so we gave those grants out to municipalities. In terms of the work that you do in conformance with the Highlands Council, when we give you an amended grant, we then do a scope that you work with your professionals. They know each task that has to be done. They know the price. If we change it and add on, then we can go to the council and add on the money. But we can't tell you now we want three more tasks done because we gave you funding for five tasks for X amount of dollars. Those five tasks must be done for X amount. If we add on three more, we can give you more funding. And if we don't give you more funding, frankly, you don't have to do it because we have to pay.
With those five tasks that you mandate us to do and you give us the money for it, but it's not enough to cover the not-to-exceed contract.
If you clearly know what the job is, I mean, we're not changing it. What you were talking about with COA was changes being made afterwards where they were coming in and saying, well, no, now we want you to do this, sending it back, no,
well,
change
actually,
it.
Actually, what they wanted was information from you guys. That's what they told us.
If anybody wants information from us, come to us. We will answer the phones ourselves.
That's
we
right.
will
they
see which,
plan
you know
was
that.
To you, to the Highlands Council, to get the information, and they were told they had to pay for it.
That's what we were told.
Well, if you're told anything like that, bring us in. We're very clear on how we deal with people. We also deal directly with municipalities. We don't let consultants dictate the work. We have great relationships with them. We work with the town.
I understand what you're saying about you don't let them dictate. They gave us a not-to-exceed amount. We went with. When they, prior to them being complete, there was information that they needed to submit to the state that they needed to get from the Highlands Council, but they were charged for it.
We don't charge anybody.
We would have never charged for any of
that. Well,
that's
Rich.
Okay, we're being recorded. We have never charged a municipality for anything. We haven't even charged a fee for any of the redevelopment planning we do. We don't charge fees. We charge no cost.
Okay, so, but if that required more work on their part to get the information from you, at their hourly rate that they're entitled to bill us for because they have to get that information from you. Is that the same thing?
When they get information from us, our information is posted online or we have
to.
If they're charging you to get information from us, they're getting it free from us.
But their man hours, because they're the professional that we hire, and that when they're doing the work, they get paid for it. If they needed the information from you guys, cause us to pay a higher rate than what we agreed to with them because they had to do more work that was required by the state, but they had to get it from you, we were on the hook for the balance of the bill.
Mr. All I can say to you is, A, if the state needed it, it was Council on Affordable Housing. So let's just be clear, it wasn't the Highlands mandating it. Any information we have, we share with everyone. We put it on our website. We don't charge them. Someone is not dealing directly or straight on this issue. We don't charge. So if a consultant is going to charge you, what does he have to do? Send us an email and say, hey, can I have your shape files on that? Boom, we send them. If we have to put them on a CD, we don't say, give me $5 for the CD. Here's the CD. If Rich calls us and says, my consultant says he wants X, and you guys have it, if we have it, you get it. So I wasn't in the middle of this.
If I remember this correctly, Mr. Higgins, and maybe I'm not on the same page as you, the consultant was not paid that extra money. I think they did work above and beyond without our permission beforehand, and when they submitted the bill, we essentially told them to go scratch.
It was actually required to complete the
Wasn't it a module that they did that they were not authorized?
It had something to do with COVID. And all I know is they get $25,000 and they want $12,000. Listen, so why is it to our advantage right now? If the master plan is good for 10 years, why would we want to change it less than halfway through? Why would we want to review it?
The planning board recommended it mostly because of
potential changes to the code book, riparian slope ordinance, and solar ordinance.
So for three ordinances, we're going to review our master plan?
Well, the review of the code book might not be only three ordinances. That could be many ordinances. You know, the short answer to your question is, do we have to do it this year? No. But we have to do it eventually. But the planning board is recommending that it be done again, so this is why it's back before council.
All right, who would pay for the density study?
What's the density study?
Other towns, you want to build out more in the borough, right?
We provide funding to do a complete build-out analysis, which looks at capacity and infrastructure capacity for both water, wastewater, zoning, and how much capacity would be needed for that development. So we provide funding for a full build-out analysis. And actually, we do most of the work. We do most of the work up front, provide it to your consultant to quality check.
The 33 towns that have been approved today, each of those has a fully approved build-out analysis. They've done all that work. We paid for it.
How much influence do you have with the DEP in regards to Category 1 streams and wastewater management?
State law is state law with regard to Category 1 streams or anything. In terms of wastewater management, we do the wastewater management plans for the towns that work with us.
We just include those.
Yeah, no, we didn't. I did. That's why I was saying it wasn't much help to you when I was talking about that. But we work. But you haven't had it approved under the 2008 rules. The wastewater management plan. No. Nobody has.
We're in the planning area, correct?
You are.
35% of the towns that are in the planning area have voluntarily conformed.
To date. Yes.
How many more are in the works?
Well, in terms of, we had notice of intent from 72 towns, and we have formal petitions from 60.
But that includes preservation.
That's exactly right. Exactly. But that would have been the difference, though, because it would have been all the planning.
With 12 more towns,
yeah, 12.
That are working with us.
And what's the situation with Hackettstown? Are they?
Hackettstown have been approved.
They have been approved.
They've been approved.
They went forward.
Yes, they went forward.
Okay.
Mayor Lavery is the mayor over there.
So Hackettstown was approved with very similar conditions we put on that last slide, which their focus was on sustainable economic development, redevelopment, planning as the primary focus.
I have a couple of questions that may be germane to that, because you had mentioned that the Highlands Council would review, say, my question is this, what influence would you have on the borough's business redevelopment and historic preservation, even though we might have already just, you know, accomplished, you know, quite a bit there. So,
yeah, I mean, we would be able to provide funding to complete those aspects that have not been completed. We have technical expertise on staff that can provide assistance. But to the extent you've already completed those tasks, those are done.
All right. So supposing, I mean, so what's the extent of, say, can you give me, for example, of like how much money maybe would be available for, say, business improvement district, you know, funding?
Well, I can maybe give you Phillipsburg and Hackettstown as examples.
Yeah.
The range of funding, it's very site-specific for the town.
Sure, right.
But the range of funding can be anywhere between the towns that went through the first process, there was a $100,000 grant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was to do build-out, environmental resource inventory, your affordable housing planning, a master plan, and ordinance. So the range of costs for the towns is somewhere around between $60,000 and $80,000 as cost towns.
Okay.
Then the additional long-term plans, like a sustainable economic development plan, a redevelopment plan, the range of those is going to be another $50,000 to $75,000 for all those other plans.
Now, are any of these like matching grant type situations where
we
have to lay out money for any of these programs whatsoever?
We have to pay the reasonable costs associated with those plans.
But they're not totally hands-off. In other words, you guys have some influence and some say-so in what we do, or no?
Well, there's a good example, is that if you were doing a master plan that sought to build out the southwest corner of the borough, we would say we're not going to be encouraging development of that area.
But I'm focused more on the business revitalization side.
As Eileen said, you know, you're a center.
Yeah.
We're focusing economic development in centers. We want to use the wastewater capacity for those centers and not have it go out and destroy agricultural lands.
So, without a doubt, the redevelopment planning is focused on the areas of the town that you identify for economic development.
Let's just tell you about Byram Township.
What about the business revitalization?
Well, the funding was set aside for a sustainable economic development plan, which would be in line with that type of approach.
But what influence might you have then over, like, what say so? So, in other words, would you have rules, mandatory rules we would have to follow?
Our rules.
Or we can just say, okay, this is what we want to do.
The master plan is concerned with two primary issues in your case: capacity for water and wastewater, and resource protection. In the existing community zone, we're saying that the resources are very limited, and that therefore they're not going to be stringent environmental standards in a center. That's
right.
The purpose of the center.
They're not going to rewrite our plan.
No.
And
no.
Resources, if that's what you're asking.
No, I'm not going to comment. You know, I thought I'd be very clear. I'm specifically concerned about, well, you had mentioned that maybe we should wait a minute until this is signed.
Yeah, give it a minute, because there'll be more.
Okay.
No, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
My question had to do with the business revitalization, and where you had said, like, that area as well as historic preservation, you would have programs available. And among these programs, okay, I mean, obviously there's going to be grant money from you guys, so I'm wondering what the Highlands Council is going to mandate for the borough in those two areas.
We don't mandate uses of those areas.
Okay. Well, that was my question.
Sorry.
That's why I wanted to use Byram as an example, because Byram had done some advanced planning for their center, and they wanted single-family residences, they wanted duplexes, they wanted retail and commercial and civic uses. They knew exactly and precisely what they want. They showed it to us all. They put in their own guidelines for architecture, because they wanted it to look like, you know, a little village, just like Byram would be expected to look like. And the council just said yes. The council didn't say, well, where are you putting those, or where are you putting, or try to dictate. Because I know what you're concerned about.
Yeah.
You think that.
But they met, or not?
They were disapproved. And in fact, the same with you. Like, when we're looking at this, we're not going to say, oh, we think should be retail there, commercial there, and residential there. No. The idea is that we recognize this existing community. The main thing, as Tom said, is if you say we want to build a skyscraper, we're going to say, what wastewater do you need? What water do you need? Do you have it?
Okay. Yeah.
That's our big issue.
Yeah, we generally don't regulate uses at all, unless it's going to impact capacity issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Mrs. Gleaver?
I have kind of going along with what you're asking. I guess, like, what are the things we would now need to do to conform to Highlands?
It's relatively straightforward.
It kind of sounds like, oh, you're just going to give us grant money, but what do we have to do for you, is what I'm asking, I guess.
Yeah, but it's relatively straightforward. With a community like yours that's a center, it's essentially the normal course of business doesn't apply. The normal course of business, if you just use another town, I mean, look at the township, Washington Township around it. There's resource areas and agricultural areas where we're saying do not expand sewers in those areas. In the case of the borough, where you want to develop and redevelop is consistent with our plan. So your existing borough is very consistent with everything in the master plan. So essentially what it is developing a scope for an economic development plan, developing a scope for a redevelopment plan, and making sure we look at the capacity issues regarding water and wastewater to see how much capacity you have to do the growth you want to do.
Okay. Then I guess my question is more to the mayor. If we last did our municipal plan in 2004, I just don't understand why all of a sudden now with this code book. Well, I was just looking at the code book contact. I mean, this, like, snowballing this code book, you know, what we were trying to accomplish here. And I don't understand why now we have to look at our master plan. The municipal master plan.
Again, have to? No, don't have to. The planning board, its professionals, its members are saying if there are going to be major changes to the code book, we should review the master plan and make sure the master plan will reflect those changes that may come to the code book.
Right, okay, but we haven't really gotten what we've been doing. We haven't really gotten a lot of major maybe I'll take this offline, because I guess that we need to. The planning board should come to one of the COVID meetings, because we're looking to you. You're not telling us then what are the ordinances that you want to be changed.
No,
you know,
we can go through.
Well, we don't know what they are. you know, the
then we don't need to worry about it until we ever have that kind of a case. That would just be a normal, you know, in a couple of years, maybe there's a new ordinance. Like, we just passed a solar one. That would be a new supplement into the code book. It was not like...
Right. Yeah, again, it's not that it has to be done this coming year, but this is done in anticipation. We are going to have to do it within the next 4 years. The state's going to mandate that, you know, by 2017.
You know, 2017.
We're going to have
that's
it
done.
2007 was the last one.
Yeah, 2007.
I thought you said 2004.
No, I said
no.
He did say
2007.
I wrote it down.
Yeah. 2004.
Yeah.
Can I dovetail a question off of what Mr. Reuter asked? So if we conform, you tell us then that we can't provide sewer service for someone in the township because you want to keep it for the construction here in the borough.
No, I think you might want to keep it for construction here in the borough. We are actually working with Washington Township, and we're going to be meeting...
you just confused me. What do you mean by that? No, we might want to keep it here.
Well, if you've got extra capacity and you want to build something in the borough, I'm not sure you want to give it away to the township. That's not my call. But if the township wants to develop, it will be looking... And they do. They will be looking for infrastructure. They may be looking to you. They may be looking at other avenues. In fact, they are. But we don't dictate. We're not going to say you give it to them, or we're not.
The DEP did.
Well, we're not the DEP.
Okay, so again, this goes back. How do you interact with the DEP? The DEP then would have nothing to say about our sewer system.
If you just finished your wastewater management plan,
correct.
Then you're presumably sent it down to the department for approval.
Correct.
Once it's approved, it's an approved wastewater management plan. Then revisions are easy and amendments are easy. Washington Township will likewise do a wastewater management plan, and they will have to look for whatever capacity they want.
But if we gave them the capacity, both would have to be amended.
If you give them, if you've got a wastewater management plan and you've got additional capacity above and beyond what you need for your wastewater management plan, and Washington Township come in, they could plan it under their wastewater management plan if they have a contract or an agreement for the wastewater.
But
we don't dictate. We look to see how it happens and how it works.
But you couldn't put the brakes on that. Say there was an adjoining property to a borough property where they wanted to hook up to the sewer system, and it would make a lot of sense for them to do that. And they came to us and said, this is what we want to do, and we said, okay, we'll give you the capacity.
We'll say great, but that
wouldn't
is the
get involved time. In, you wouldn't be involved in that?
We would look to see if it's is consistent with our regional master plan. If they wanted a sewer, for example, in an area in Washington Township that was severe environmental restrictions, we would get involved with that. So it depends on
well,
the...
What
if it didn't, then it would be like
easier
this.
To
exactly.
Have
without doubt, no. In our existing community zone, we encourage sewer. So you would look...
But that's the borough I'm talking about.
Yeah, but the township has the existing community zone as well.
It has a mix. It has agricultural land, it has the existing community.
So then we would have to look on our map right there where they would want to put it.
Yep, exactly.
And then you guys would approve. Say,
correct.
Like over here.
Correct.
But if they wanted to put it somewhere else, you would know.
Yes, if they wanted to put it in prime agricultural or...
So how does that work?
But
you make a recommendation, getting back to his original question, to the DEC?
Well, what happens with towns who are working with us, we do their plan for them, and the town...
So you do the submission.
Well, the
so
town actually formally submits it.
To, yeah.
So we don't decide. We do the plan. I'll use Washington Township, Morris County as an example.
Okay.
We've worked with them. We did the first draft of the wastewater management plan, sent it to them. They had questions. We want they some areas that they actually want a sewer where they have some history of failing septic. So they worked back with us. We kept working until... We had it agreed the exact way they wanted it. Now, in the case of Washington Township, Morris County, it's very different to you, and they have areas that, yes, honestly, we were saying, this is an area we would not allow sewer to go. They make the choice whether to work with us or not. They made the decision that they got everything they needed from us, that they believe. Mainly, it was that 513 corridor and, of course, the developed area. So we worked with them. That's the idea. If we had worked with Washington Township and they wanted something along 513 and we said, no, we're not doing it, they might say, well, guess what, we're not going to work conform. That's fine. But I will tell you one other thing. Even in the planning area for wastewater management plans and water allocation plans, the Highlands Council information is used by the Department of Environmental Protection. regardless of conformance.
What we now have, if we're in, again, what, like, do we now have things that we need to provide you? Are there due dates for things, or, you know, is there more work that our professionals need to do or our manager needs to do if we're part of this island?
There's no due date for a planning area town. So there's no requirement in the Act that you conform by any period of time at all, because that only applies to the preservation area. So for planning area towns, what happens is, and this happens to all towns, we develop what's called an implementation plan and schedule, where we schedule out the activities that were alluded to in the second to last slide, or the last slide. And there,
if we already have them done, like a redevelopment plan, then...
Then they're done. Right. They're done. So it identifies the schedule and dollar amounts for tasks moving forward, which we do...
Then you would tell us, so we would have to do all those
no,
tasks?
No, it's done in a cooperative fashion where we give you a draft, you examine the draft, see if it fits within your priorities, say, I'd rather do this in 4 years' time, I'd rather do this in the next year. These are long-term plans. These are not plans that are done overnight. So these are long-term plans that will take a year, if not more, to complete, and then dollar amounts associated with that task.
But we don't come in and we just showed you an example there of the things we think you'd be interested in. In the case, for example, of Phillipsburg, they said to us, we want to focus on these two redevelopment areas. And we said, great. I mean, obviously we know about them, but, you know, those particular ones, Ingersoll Rand, I think everybody knows about. But so we, and then other towns will come in and they've said agricultural retention is the most important thing for us. So that's how the timing is scheduled as well. We prioritize those elements for those towns. And then we might say, okay, you've got 6 months to do that. And just recently we've got a town that came back in and said they wanted longer. Fine, then we just make it, it's an agreed schedule. Because we don't have any, there's no sort of time bomb ticking on us. If you say we want 9 months to do a plan for this area of town, then we'll say, great, then it's 9 months.
Mm-hmm. It's mostly to keep the professionals on task.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it also shows progress with the money. The one thing we don't want is grants being made and 3 years later us saying, you know, what are you doing with that money? What we do is we follow up. If towns that were working with us on plan performance, we say to them, hey, are you interested in staying with us? Because if they don't, you take back the money and we refund it to other towns. But that's only, again, that's why we work out a schedule with towns, because... Mm-hmm. If we try to force it on towns, they might not be able to keep up, so it's an agreed schedule. Right.
But not being with you, then we wouldn't have to do any of those things if we didn't want to.
Well, I don't know. I think the planning might dictate that you would, but that's over to you. Yeah, I mean,
have to? No.
No.
But
the thing is, do you want... It's an opportunity, let's say. It's very difficult, you know, for towns to actually plan, particularly all the elements, because you've got historic here, so you care about the architectural guidelines. So if there's a suite of things that any town wants to do to get ahead and to become a vibrant center. So you've got two choices. Usually, and from being on a planning board, you're reacting to applications that are before you. It's difficult to get the time to say, you know what, we're going to have ordinances for signs. We're going to have architectural guidelines. We never dictate those. Byron, for example, decided they wanted to use form-based code, and they wanted the town to look a certain way, and they decided what those guidelines are. Now, any developer coming in has to do it that way. So when you're out ahead, you dictate what the future, and just because it's built, you know this from your ordinance work, doesn't mean that in 10 years' time someone else isn't coming in with another vision. If you've got your guidelines in place, your planning in place, you're pretty much dictating what the future of your town looks like, not leaving it to body development.
It can be amended.
Sure. That's up to you.
So don't, anyway.
Anyone else on council have questions? Anyone from the audience have questions?
Their head must be spinning.
Okay. Yes, sir.
If I think I saw one of those slides earlier, right, I think it said the town has 1,250-some acres
mm-hmm.
in total, and I think that what you're referring to in acre tracts is about 10%, roughly 10% of what the town is. I know right now an application was approved last week in front of the planning board to develop that,
mm-hmm.
right, or do something with that site. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. You go through the whole planning process and everything like that. But chances are that could happen prior to the town adopting or being part of the Highlands group. So my question is, would that? I guess they would have to conform then to any Highlands things.
Well, what happens is, if, I'm not aware if they got local, do they get the local approval from the planning board?
Well, the actual application has been approved, but the plan itself hasn't.
What he's talking about, I believe, is the Washington Cemetery?
Yeah.
Okay, that was before the Board of Adjustment, not the planning board, and I think they just deemed the application complete.
Okay.
I think that's all it is.
But the answer to your question is, the municipal land use law applies, so the time of application is the new standard in the state of New Jersey, that the zoning and restrictions that are in the zoning ordinance and site plan subdivision ordinance are the ones that apply when you submit your application. So if you, in a later date, approve new ordinances, that applicant will have to abide only by the pre-existing ordinances. So it's all depending on when you submit your application.
We're not going to get in the way
of the
cemetery.
No.
Okay, but in, I guess, in existing cemeteries, there are prior to 2004, so they're going to be able to...
Yes.
Be grandfathered.
There's an exemption for that, actually.
Okay.
Anyone else? Yes? Ms. Noon?
I guess, if they go forward and say, okay, we want to start this process, there isn't an obligation immediately because there has to be some negotiation about what's going to happen, and then things have to be signed, I would imagine, that about what you're really going to do. So it would just be to go forward to try to see if it's something...
Yeah, the most important thing, you're absolutely right, would be you'd want to know, sort of, you'd have to want to have some idea of what you're getting into. So yeah, there'd be sort of some exploration before you go down fully and conform. And once you start doing ordinances and things, that's when it really gets better. So, your point.
And the grants that would become available, for instance, I mean, we have done a lot of work in the downtown, and the sidewalks look beautiful, the lighting looks beautiful, mm-hmm. but there's hard, there's, it's empty, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of it is very empty. So are there grants that, I mean, I guess the biggest thing is how do, you know, are there ways that the Highlands Council could help attract businesses that would be more effective maybe than what we're doing already, or has that happened somewhere?
It's difficult. All of a sudden, it's these economic times. I mean, I think everybody knows that the Highlands haven't got a magic way to bring sort of that kind of vitality in. But yes, we met with the Economic Development Authority, EDA, down at another state agency, and we already talked to the executive director there. And there are certain programs they run, including working with businesses and talking about loan structure, et cetera, where they can assist. So what we try to do working with towns is bring all of the agencies together. There's also the Business Action Center. We work with them under Lieutenant Governor Rodano. So what we do is we act as the advocate for the town so that when there are opportunities and benefits, that we would bring your town. And we do the same with the Department of Environmental Protection. We've assisted many towns in working out issues and problems with the department. Because they work with us, we know them well, and we become advocates. So could we help? Yes. We don't have tax or funding, so I'm going to tell you that. On the other hand, we can assist, and having center designation, for example, assists with certain DOT grants that aren't available if you're not a center. So we can assist, but I'm not going to promise you that things, but certainly if a town is ready and has their planning in place, there's a better opportunity for them to dictate the future of their town and avail of those opportunities.
And I'm not as aware of this, but maybe council members know better. I believe that there's a large landlord that owns a lot of the downtown buildings still. Is that correct?
Actually, if I could comment, because I think it's very relevant to what you're speaking of. Many of the vacancies have been filled,
mm-hmm.
but there are four in particular between the parking lot that we constructed and the corner here of Salvador Avenue that really, they're not rentable to a business. Properties are in
deteriorating conditions
if they're not
accountable.
Right. So I guess that's what I'm wondering about. Is there help for that that would come?
That would be the kind of, where the town would take, now I don't know that particular area, but the town could say, we want to focus on a redevelopment plan for that area. They could specifically delineate it and say, and work, and that's again where we'd look and say, well, what kind of funding would we provide you? What kind of studies do you want to do? And that's the way...
The borough did and adopted a redevelopment plan in 2007 and 2008, which everybody's aware of.
Right.
We provide, and that area is part of our redevelopment plan, but there's no magic money dream to fund the development of those buildings. And I know sometimes you don't know the intricacies of it, you would say, well, why didn't the town just condemn it and take it over? We can't just take over property. We all the taxpayers, actually, I'm not a... The residents and the taxpayers, once that property property is taken over, is now on the hook for the bill to bring that property back into shape again. And that's, so this is a very serious obstacle to all people who are working with economic development, whether you're business improvement district, whether you're the borough council, wherever you are. It's a big obstacle for all of us.
Well, that gets coming to the marketing and the advertising, because that's the phase we've moved into. And that would be something that we could work with EDA on. But again, there's no magic sort of solution in these economic times, because we're facing this throughout the state.
Ms. Ceramia brings up a good point, though, and actually that raises another question for you guys, which would be, maybe is there a way that you could possibly give us grant money that we could possibly use as an incentive to, like, landlords that own that particular commercial property to give, like, a matching grant situation where the landlord puts in half and the... we use the grant money for half. Is there any?
We don't have capital funding. We have.
You don't have any capital funding.
Right, we have planning funding. So.
Okay.
Mrs. Sloan, did you have a question? Mrs. Sloan, did you have a question?
I have a question. Because of the real estate transfers, I don't think there's been any. Just,
luckily, we don't get a percentage. We get a flat amount, and we've gotten it each year.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's the amount they take in
part. Money when there's no...
It's statewide realty transfer, so there's been, there's been plenty of...
Oh, yeah, it wouldn't be just
on. I thought it was depending on us.
No.
So, lady in the back behind you there, Tom, I have a question.
I have two questions. One, I have been there for so long. Where is the Baker track? You've been in, like, the Baker track. Where is that?
Do you know where our sewer plant is? Mediterranean Bistro, and back there, back up the hill.
Right up there. Okay. The second thing I wanted to ask, the gentleman, let him in. We were talking about being part of a plan. It sounds like you're looking more at money to do things that might environmentally impact the town if you did some other development. As far as money is concerned, so the town wouldn't have to come up with money if you change your ordinances?
Well, I was referring to what was mentioned in the email sent to us by the engineer, saying that the costs would be covered by the Highlands money and therefore saving the taxpayers quite a bit of money for, because a lot of these studies and work that has to be done costs a lot of money.
Okay. Yeah, the lady here was talking about with the master plan out about wastewater and water usage. And I know you were saying about somebody adding on to usually when you start to do stuff like that, and I don't know what the borough wants to do, that's usually where you come into a lot of money when you start talking about wastewater or sewers or whatever. So, I mean, if they're not dictating, it doesn't sound like they are anyway, then when you get ready to do that and you have the plan and the money there, then that's where you need to go. Because everybody's broke, town broke, tax credit, and go, you know, you need that kind of stuff. Just as long as, like you said, Mr. Higgins, that you're not saying, we're going to give you this, that there are strings attached, because I really don't like that either. Because I think every community has a different idea of what they want their towns to look like, what they should be like. So you guys should be, it sounds like it's more, you're on more of like an advisory type, almost.
We do become advocates. If we were having this conversation in some towns, I'm going to tell you we're stricter, because when we're talking about great expanse of agricultural land, the huge forest up in Sussex County. Yeah, we're going to stand there and there's going to be people in the room going, wait a second, you're not going to, if I had 200 acres, you know, before you came along, we could have developed it. And we're like, that's true, because the Act and the DEP rules apply. Washington Borough is different.
Right.
You know, we're not going to save the water of the state in Washington Borough. Because you are a community, and that's what you were built to be. If all the region had developed like this, and had kept that model of the dense development in the centers and not sort of sprawling out, and I don't care whether it's 5 acre or a 10 acre lot, 5 acre, 10 acre, 15, it keeps spreading, it cuts the trees down. The agriculture doesn't really hold up under that kind of development. That's what this act is meant to stop, but it's not meant to stop. You are a center.
Okay.
So being in the planning area, we pay for the planning. We don't pay for what gets done after. plants. You just said you're paid for the plants.
We pay for the reasonable cost of anything relating to conforming to the master plan.
And that's for planning. So we go do another redevelopment plan. It costs us another $100,000. You guys kick in. We're like, thank you very much. Now we have to implement the plan, and the cost of implementing that plan falls on the borough.
No, what I was saying is we don't have capital funding.
Right.
You're paying for your professionals to implement a plan. Our planning costs that can be reimbursed, providing for.
All right, we've already had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
You going to reimburse us for some of that?
We gave you $52,000. I think.
Yeah, we already.
Yeah. You used it with higher. Well, we didn't dictate anything. We gave you the $52,000. That's been some of your planning. One would hope. Today.
Okay, but what did it cost us? See, here's what I'm trying to say. Not everything is what reasonable costs, and it's reasonable determined by your professionals, correct? Your engineers, your planners, your attorneys, this is what's reasonable.
We've got the same.
When we do the planning, we have to pay attorneys, we have to pay planners, we have to pay engineers, right? They come up and they say, this is what you should do. We either buy it or we don't. How does that benefit the town?
Well,
that benefits those professionals, not the town. That's my personal opinion.
So if you don't want to plan and you don't have any plans you want to accomplish and you're not going to be doing your new master plan, you don't have any ordinances, we pay for the ordinance costs as well, the public hearings, all of that, then that's fine. We're here because the town said they wanted to do some planning. We provide the money. You don't have to plan at all.
Ms. Swan, if I can interrupt you, this is the third time that you guys have been before us with the same thing. This is the third time. Nothing's changed.
Mr. Higgins, last time we were with you, we didn't have one town that had been conformed. We've now got 33. We didn't have one planning area. Lots has changed. It doesn't have to change for you.
A lot has changed.
We've been invited here three times. We've come three times at your invitation. I will come a fourth, fifth, and a sixth time at your invitation.
It wasn't at the council's request that you gave me.
Well, we certainly didn't dictate. We were invited here.
Okay,
I've never
you were
gone
invited,
to
but not by the council.
Well, let's not, nitpick here.
Well, to the
you
public,
know,
we were invited by
yes.
your town here.
You know, if you want, I invited him. If that makes it easier, I invited him. You want to give somebody hell about it, you give me hell for it.
And the planning board
okay.
is to have Highlands come to readdress the council, as I had read in the memo.
The thing is, we see upcoming costs coming, joining in with the Highlands. We can have them pay for it, or we can have our taxpayers pay for it. If you want to have the Highlands pay for it, we go forward. If you want to have our taxpayers pay for it and as it comes up and delay it, you know, that's up to us, too.
We don't have to do it now?
No, you don't. You're going to have to do it in the next 4 years, though.
And, Mr. Higgins, if in 2 years you want us back again to talk, if I'm still there, I'll come back again and talk.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Any other questions? Thank you all.
Okay.
Thank you.
In closing, Mr. Mayor, I just want to say that we do this throughout the region. And in areas like yours, we're very pleased to be here to tell you, bring you up to date on where we are. We work for the state. We're using state tax dollars. They may be of benefit to you. If they are, it's up to your community. But we're very pleased to serve, and thank you for having us here this evening.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We'll just take a few minutes to
sure,
drag you away.
Council wish to have any discussion while they're cleaning up about this? Okay. Then that takes us on to our correspondence. We have a memo from the Planning Board and a document from the Business Improvement District. The memo from the Planning Board, I believe, is on your desks this evening. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, any discussion?
Yes.
Certainly.
From the planning board.
Okay.
What kind of dollar amount are we talking here?
I did not bring that with me this evening.
I had the same question.
$4,500?
I had the same question.
Yeah, I believe it's in the neighborhood of $4,500.
that the overage was.
Okay, so taking this back to Rich, you would have to find out where he gets $4,500 from when he makes transfers, correct?
Correct.
Rich, is this stemming from earlier in the year where there was work done without knowledge or remember that? And this is why they stopped it?
Yes. Okay. Yes. You're referring to the email that we sent out? Yeah, that was it.
Correct. Okay.
Okay, any other discussion on any of this?
I have a quick question on the bids. Annual plan here, if I'm pronouncing that right. The budget business plan.
Yes,
sir. On page 9, the parking lot improvement project.
Okay.
We had the executives here maybe before the summer. We were looking to pay that off earlier.
Yes.
Where did that stand?
We did
come back and do anything with that?
No, we did not vote to pay it off. At that time? Yeah. And we haven't gone any further with it since then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought that I was told that council would relook at it as part of the 2012.
The 12?
Okay. Yeah, we would look at it again, but as of this moment, nothing further has been done.
That's all I had. Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, roll call, please. I'm sorry, this is all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions?
Mr. Boyle, can I prevent you to bring the podium back over there for me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to open up the audience portion for remarks, petitions, statements, and testimony from guests. Ms. Detlin.
What happened to our place of recess?
We met always. And then at 6:30.
Before 7:30?
Yes.
Well, that's nice. We're the
public.
It was advertised.
Oh,
okay. What was it? You can say it by yourself. Okay.
Anyone else? Oh. Yes, sir.
Paul Jones, my wife Cynthia, and I moved to Washington about a year and a half ago, and I have a little situation I'd like to get clarified with the council, if I could.
Your address for the record, please, Mr. Jones?
108 Harding Drive.
Thank you.
On the front corner of our property are two catch basins that I've been told were put in by the borough 5, 6, 7 years ago to collect water that was coming down off the hill and was creating a icing problem in the wintertime in the corner of Flower and Harding. What I had proposed to do, or what I wanted to do, was take my downspouts and drain them into these catch basins, diverting water because of the big water issues we've had in the past few months. When I called the borough and I spoke to Richard, he advised me that they're on my property and that they're my catch basins, because I wanted approval from the borough to tie my downspouts into these. Now, what I want to find out is, are they my catch basins? Because the borough put them in, I didn't, or my previous owner didn't. And if I can get approval from the town to tie my downspouts into them. Pretty simple.
In generalities, if they're on your property, they're yours, and you can tie your downspouts into them. As far as the borough putting them in, do you have any documentation stating?
Only what your maintenance foreman told me.
Everything's verbal. There's no paperwork?
No paperwork.
Dating it over?
Richard and John were both out at the house probably a month and a half ago when this issue first came up. And John said that they had put them in to divert this water. And he also told me at that time that I believe they had told the homeowners that if they wanted to tie their downspouts into them, they could. My question is, if that the borough put them in, I'm assuming it's the borough's property, But my other problem is that if they are mine and something happens to these catch basins or the piping that diverts the water, am I responsible for financially to repair them?
In speaking in generalities,
yeah, I mean, Rich, we don't have any documentation.
There's no recorded maintenance easement for any.
That would tie right left. Yeah, that works well. No offense, I hope.
None at all. I mean, if it's on your property, I would think that it would be yours to take care of and maintain and do with as you please.
Well, if the borough put them in and I don't want them there, get them off my property. I mean, you know, what can I tell you?
Well, these were put in when the previous owner
Correct.
Had it. Okay, so you bought the property with them on it.
Correct.
So I guess that they're yours. I think that we probably need legal advice on this.
Yes, because it could be an easement.
I did speak with the borough attorney and borough engineer on this at great length. The borough attorney advised that just because the borough installed them, and I know you and I spoke about this briefly about a week or so ago,
mm-hmm.
Just because the borough installed them does not make it the borough's property. They were installed for, according to the road supervisor, to address drainage issues,
Correct.
Your flower and harding, as well as for the three or four properties that affect. The tax dollars were used to install that for the benefit of those three or four property owners. There is no recorded easement for maintenance on those. They were installed by the borough at the direction of a prior engineer, prior manager, and current DPW employees. The basins there are outside of the borough's right-of-way, and there's no recorded agreement with even your predecessor in that home for maintenance.
Okay.
This was installed for the benefit of those property owners. In concert with that, my engineer had gone out there before you and I spoke the first time, had gone out there for one of your other neighbors, and I forgot which address it was off the top of my head. Forgot. I'm a little congested too myself. So, the engineer went out there to look at another property owner's similar circumstances as you, and I'll read directly what his response was. The drainage problems in the area are due to standing water on the properties due to the minimal slope of the properties. As a result, the slope does not allow all of the water to flow from the yard in the rear to the front drain or to the borough's infrastructure, meaning storm sewers on Harding Drive. The issues are solely due to the physical characteristics of the property, of private property, excuse me, and it's not the borough's responsibility to maintain the private property. A possible resolution would be for residents to regrade their properties to direct the flow of the water from the rear to the front. As I said to you when we spoke, I mean, I can't give you permission to tie into something that you own. It's yours. You have a right to tie into it.
I have a right to take it out also?
You're going to have an adverse effect on your property.
And probably the street on Harding and down on Flower with the water issue and freezing ice in the roads and so on and so forth.
The borough, this borough council, unless this is a policy decision that has to be made by the governing body. They've made a policy in the past to not use public money to maintain private property. They want to change that policy, by all means, we'll schedule it.
We're not maintaining private property. The catch basins are there to serve a purpose, which I'd like to leave them there to protect the rest of the citizens on the street. All I requested to do was get permission because the borough would put them in, but apparently I don't need permission from you people to tie my downspouts into it.
No, I don't believe so.
Correct, because you own it.
Well, that's another issue. Like I said, if somewhere down the road something happens to those catch basins and they become not functionable, is it going to be my responsibility to fix them?
In its current form, yes. There's no my municipal Department of Public Works has never maintained any of the basins that were installed on private property in that area. Not
I
once.
Ask a question. Being quite familiar with this, who was it that said that those things were put in for the benefit of those three properties?
The DPW supervisor.
That's not necessarily true.
I mean,
the reason they were put in there is because of the ice built up at Harden and Flower. So they would have, there would be 4, 5, 6 inches of ice because through his property, there is a pipe, because there is an underground spring at the top of the mountain there, and if you go out there and check, you can see where the curb is cut out, where the pipe through his property goes into the street. Once that water went into the street, it flowed down to Harding and Flower. That's why it was changed. When they went up there to say, how do we rectify this, it was easy to say, put those basins in right here and connect it. As you can see, if you went up there, their driveway was cut.
Three or four properties, man.
The way the pipe from those basins to the borough storm system, stormwater collection system. Now, if those collapse and it goes all over the road again, what happens then?
That's a policy decision for this governing body.
They were put in for the purpose of preventing the ice buildup.
This was at the advice of the attorney. I'm passing the information along. If this body wants to make a policy decision to maintain private property with public money, we'll do so.
Were you on council when this was put in, Mr. Higgins?
Pardon me?
Were on council when this was put in?
Let's see here. I don't believe I was.
Okay. So none of us were then.
But I was over there watching them every day. And they actually did put another storm drain in, a flat one, at Harding and Flower.
Mm-hmm.
That's not up against the curb. It's actually about 3 feet away from the curb in the middle of the road to catch the additional water.
There's about three or four properties that had these, for lack of a phrase, catch basins. They're not true catch basins. They're miniature ones, if you will, that were placed on their property. They're all at the front end of the property, outside the borough's right-of-way. Goes, I guess that is what, south? Is it south? No, it's west. Excuse me. It goes west down, and it ties into a catch basin further down the road.
Do we know how deep these things are?
You can reach
the
bottom.
Last time
we reached.
Today, and I looked, the grates are very small.
No, I reached down and touched the bottom, maybe 2 feet, two and a half feet. It's not that deep. No, it's just gravel and a pipe. It's PVC. At the bottom, there's gravel, and it's a plastic basin with a PVC pipe tied into it, and it works its way down the street.
Did the engineer project what type of maintenance would be involved with these things? Or?
Can't say. It was a former engineer directed by a former manager.
Did you talk to our current one?
Oh, no. Our current one went out there and looked at it, and I read his recommendations.
Did he mention anything about types of maintenance that would be required?
The only type of maintenance that would ever be required is if the line cracks or gets clogged. That's the short version.
That little small, we're still talking about the small piece in there.
Yeah. Well, the piece itself vertically or the horizontal pipe that ties in, which goes, what, about 50 or so feet down, 60 feet down, and ties into the main.
We established that would be Mr.
Jones,
his responsibility, that part there?
Our conversation ended before we got that far, but in essence, the borough's position was, or at least I shouldn't say the borough's, my position was it was private property, you know, therefore any maintenance and or repair would fall on the private property owner the way any other piece of private property would.
We're just talking about the base, we're not talking about the contributing lines coming into it, correct?
Well, there's no contributing lines coming into it, it's leaving it. There's nothing feeding into it. It's a base in here.
I was there today.
There's no lines feeding in, though.
Yeah, there is.
Well, that's my down.
No, that's
yes.
That part there, that's, we already established that's Mr. Jones' deal there. So now the line's getting from there down. They run all the way down to the storm sewer collection basin at the end of Harding?
I think it's about 30 feet in from the end or so, 20 feet in from the end, yeah. You can see the saw cut right down three or four properties on the driveway where they laid the pipe.
Just a point of information, if I could. At one time, the borough, had to have an easement to go into somebody else's property in order to do that and put in and pay for those catch basins that are there. So, in all responsibility, the borough should, in my opinion, not legal opinion, but in my opinion, we should take the responsibility and continue to pay for any repairs that do need to be made on something that we put in on somebody else's property. Just like as if it was, you know, a whole sewer line. And if the sewer pipe cracked, we'd have to go under there and fix it. And it would be not the homeowner's responsibility.
I would agree with you with one exception, Mr. Torres. There is no easement that authorized us to put that on the property. Oh, so we just went ahead onto somebody's private
Mr.
land,
Torres,
in your opinion.
What has happened sometimes in the past is things were done verbally and not on paper.
There's
and
no
this
recording.
May be one of those circumstances. I think maybe we should reach out
to
Mr.
Sciola, so maybe we
who
can
was
amend
the manager at that time,
point.
And ask him what his recollection of it all is.
You made the best statement at all. That's the reason I'm here tonight, because I'd like to have something on paper, not verbally.
Yeah. You know, that's gotten us into trouble more than once. But I think maybe a call to Mr. Sciola.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you guys talk about it and give you about a week and get back to me.
Okay.
A week worth of government's work?
We'll
definitely
chew on this one.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Mrs. Pyle.
That's right, Pyle, 88 West Jewett Street. And I have a couple of questions. Yes, I can, I think. It's a little high.
You can take it out and hold it. It's easier.
Now, can you hear me?
Better, thank you.
Oh, all right. First of all, are all these big branches and limbs that have fallen, including on my property, going to be picked up?
Yes.
They are.
Mm-hmm. It will be a couple of weeks, you know, in order to get through it all. Some cases we have to wait for GCP&L to come out and remove wires from them. I don't know if that's the case on your property or not. But in some cases that is.
Now, does it have to be chopped up?
The branches themselves, but by you mean?
Yeah.
No, not by you.
If I may, we are holding the same requirements. We do make special pickups for storm-damaged trees, which is fine. But if someone just has a whole tree on the side of the road, we're not going to take it. It still needs to be placed into manageable sizes for the crew to pick them up.
What's a manageable size?
I think what we put on the website was stumps no larger than 14 inches and tree branches, if you're going to be tied together, have to be enough for an average, you know, employee to pick up and load onto the truck.
Joyce, do you need help on the property? You and move them out there? I'll help you move them out.
Yeah, my neighbor got them out there, but he didn't cut them up in chunks or whatever you call it.
I mean, if there's a 20-foot tree trunk, we're not going to be able to pick that
up.
It's
not a
trunk. I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah.
Large limbs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be manageable that it can be picked up and moved.
One or two people.
Two people could pick them up.
Then it should be fine.
Second question. My alley is deteriorating, and I don't know. Years ago, not that many years ago, they used to come by and they'd fill the potholes. I've got potholes that you could step in and lose your foot, and you go. I mean, it's hard on your car, and it's also eroding on both sides of the...
Didn't you tell us this a few months ago?
No.
Mm-mm.
But I am now.
I must have you confused with someone else. I remember hearing a similar story. I thought it was...
This is in the rear of your home, you said?
It's in the what?
The rear of your home?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's used, and of course, a lot of other people... I always say you should only... People that live there should use that alley, but that's ridiculous, I guess. But if they're really getting bad...
No problem. I can have them repaired.
All right. And when they come into them, not only are the potholes, but the sides of the alley is eroding away. I mean, it's getting narrower and narrower. Before long, we're going to be driving in the ditch.
I'll inform my DPW after they're finished with all the brush collection, which obviously is going to take some time.
How many people do you have in the group, the DPW?
Well, including the seasonals or just the regular?
Regular.
Five.
You have five men working. Because I was wondering, because it's a lot of work in this borough. There should be plenty of people that can, you know, you should have enough employees to work to keep it decent, because the roads are really getting bad.
We have five full-time employees, and then we hire seasonals throughout the year, depending on the need.
All right. So you're going to fix.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank
you, sir.
Ms.
I'm Josephine Noon. I live at 14 Prosper Way. I actually have some questions about similar road in Jefferson Street. It's basically like a dirt track now.
That's the road right between you and Advance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's a part of it that is just dirt, and that leads to Ms. Ross's property, but the other way, going out towards the boulevard, I guess, it goes in front, Jefferson Street in front of where Reliable Auto is and the auto body shops, and then it and goes out towards the boulevard. That is, it's not a very large street, but it's a mess. And then that the bridge coming into Prosper Way from 57 is really bad and continues. I know it gets patched. I think, you know, it gets patched and it gets patched. It seems to be subsiding into the, is it the Shabacon Creek? And, of course, right by Advance Auto Parts, this last, I guess, the storm after Hurricane Irene, there is a huge part of the bank that was gouged out at that point.
By the bridge.
By the water. But, yes, right by the bridge to the east of the bridge, in front of Advance Auto Parts, there's, like, a bank there, and you can see, like, a huge part. Actually, it's just dirt now.
Is that bridge ours or
that's what I'm thinking. I'm not sure if that's a state or a county bridge.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to check on that.
And then the last part of that is, I guess, that Shabacon Creek goes then under that used, yeah, it goes under the parking lot for the used car dealership, and you can see that subsiding too. I would assume that's maybe private property, but it just seems to me like that whole section is something needs to maybe be done about the road there, because the creek, maybe because of all the flooding over and over again, seems to be really affecting the underneath, I guess, so that it's all sinking.
The Department of Environmental Protection really regulates water flow,
mm-hmm.
and they tremendously restrict what you can or can't do
yep.
along the water way there. And if the water's natural path decides to, you know, erode more,
mm-hmm.
we're very limited in what we can or can't
right.
do for repair. I mean, we can go take a look at it, see
sure.
what, if anything, can be done.
I guess that sort of almost speaks to what Mr. Higgins was saying about if we do something with the Highlands Council, if they can help us with all these issues with that Shabacon Creek path through the borough, because it seems to me that we continually now have issues where we have incredible flooding in that area to the point of it being rather scary, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my neighbor, Dorothy Rost, her house is constantly completely surrounded by water. It's like she lives in an island there, and it happens all the time. And, you know, 30 years ago, maybe that happened every 10 years. That seems to happen, you know, 5 times a year now. So I don't know what the answer to that is, but certainly that's a big issue.
I laugh because I was listening to WRNJ earlier today, and they were talking how they had 2 50-year storms in the last 4 years kind
yeah.
of thing.
So I don't, you know, again, I don't know what,
yes.
as you're saying, the DEP controls that, but certainly that's an issue for the whole borough. I think there is a lot of flooding along that.
Can you have the road department supervisor take a look at that?
Yep, we can go take a look. I don't know if that is, but it's a tributary off of a Category 1, so it falls under the same requirements. I don't think that far up it's considered a 1, but I'd have to look at the map.
Anyone else for the audience portion?
Susan Sloan, 89 Grand Avenue. I want to thank Sandy.
Oh, she just left.
She's gone. Oh, well. She did
she's
good.
She's going to come back, I think, though. Oh, her coat's here, so maybe you want to save it?
No, go ahead and put it on the record.
Well, anyway, I want to, she did a very, I read the whole thing.
No, we can't hear you. Shove it,
Edna. All right, can you hear me? It's not on. Just
shove any little
there we go.
Rocket show.
Now yours is on. Is this on? Oh, thank you. My fellow Americans, I'd like to thank Sandy for a really good report. My only concern for both this council and the BID is that you buy as much stuff. Thank you, Sandy, for a great report. But I would like to ask the council and the BID if they buy as much services and goods within the borough of Washington. because I noticed on, even on your, for engineers, I understand, but I think it should be a priority for the council and the bid to use businesses within the borough at all times. That's just an observation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just glad we got a two-sided paper now.
Okay, anyone else? Hearing none, I'd accept a motion to close the audience portion.
Second.
Okay, any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Recreation Director, and I guess the Recreation Chairperson, Mr. Fitzgerald, Mr. Cione.
Mayor, members of council, you have before you a
You have it turned up. You may be able to leave it in there now.
Is that all right? Okay. Thank you. You have before you a revised ordinance for the fees within the recreation program. Basically, what I've looked at is to create something that I'm calling equal rates, to look at the different programs. To take a simple example that I've used, if you take softball that happens in the springtime and has 24 games and requires grass to be cut twice a week and fields to be lined each time they do it, the raking of the infield, the gas to do that, the manpower to do it, as compared to soccer, for example, that operates in the fall where you're cutting grass once a week. They play games once a week, practice the rest of the time, so that the number of times they have to be maintained or cut or lined is somewhere around 10 or 12 games. So taking that kind of borough expense for each one of those type of things, adding that to the existing programs that are in each one of the programs there, uniforms if they have them, league fees and what they are, bunching those together, and try to come up with an equitable rate that reflects those actual costs of the program, divided into the number of people who participate in the program, number of registrations there are, to come up with a fee. And that's what you're looking at.
And plus, we also did research on other contiguous towns that offer a similar program and what they charge, so you want to be in comparison with your competition.
All the rates that we have here are at or below the ones that are in surrounding towns. Entertain questions, because there's obviously looking at cold numbers doesn't answer it.
Yeah,
it might have been explained once before, but the minimum maximum definition, and how does that apply?
Well, that applies to create a min and max in the ordinance, but the rate, as long as it falls between those, can be changed by resolution. Let's suppose that we have a drop-off in the softball program next spring, and they can't afford to do it at that rate, then we want to make some kind of change in the program. Let's suppose next fall, when soccer is playing, I think you know that we've entered into this whole discussion with Musco and the lighting program, and we defined it a great deal more, so that we're identifying exactly the hours that are using the lights. But that's a big factor. That's going to be a factor in how soccer adjusts their program next year, because we have it set now at limitations. Now, the manager is the only authorized person to change the parameters of the program.
If I can cut you off there for just a second, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Boyle, to answer your question a little more directly, what we went back, did before, is we set the min and the max in the ordinance, because that way, by doing it resolution, we don't have to republish the ordinance constantly.
Correct. I understand.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Definition, when would the minimum apply? I mean, you're going by participants?
The minimum max affects the rate that we're suggesting. We suggest a rate within the min-max range. That way, if there is a change and it stays within the min-max, all we have to do is come back to you for a resolution change to increase that rate, rather than to go back and change the ordinance itself.
I think what he's asking is, the prices that are on here are assuming a similar rate of participation that you had the previous year.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yeah. They're based upon that number.
If it was lower or higher, would that affect the rate?
It might have to affect the rate, yes, in which case we would have to come back for a recommendation to change the rate, up or down.
But not after you've already started signups, correct?
Right, not, that's exactly right.
I just have one other question and one other observation. For the full fees membership, in parentheses, all memberships have price after August 1st. What's the reasoning behind that?
Experience in Belvedere. We find that, having run the one in Belvedere for the last 5 years, we do that because participation drops off terribly. It just becomes a factor of vacations, back to school, and all the rest of the things that affect the family. So by doing this, we increase the amount of activity. It generates income. The rest of the fees that a pool generates are pretty much fixed. You're going to have two lifeguards up, one down, the rest of that salary type of thing. You're going to use a certain amount of chlorine. Anything that adds to the revenue side of the thing, of the whole discussion, is important.
Also, I actually got a lot of calls from residents that basically would call me and say, you know, my kids are home from camp now. I don't want to pay for a full membership because it's already August. So the logic was, if we reduce the rate, and even the day rates, you know, being cut to $3 after 6 p.m., I know a lot of working parents, myself included, would not necessarily take the kids to the pool for an hour or two and pay the full price. But at $3, you would likely see much more, many more people at the pool, because the few times I did go this year after 6 o'clock, there was maybe 5 people at the pool.
Okay.
So the goal is, again, to get more people there.
Okay, very good. And the last thing I had, just noticed from my going to my meeting for Rotary, the lights were on at the park on
today?
Monday.
Mm-hmm.
There were people there?
Soccer practice, probably.
Really?
The way the lights are working now is we investigated this whole Musco program, and in 2007, I believe it was, you signed a 25-year maintenance-free agreement with Musco.
Yeah, no,
but we pay the electricity.
With all that snow and the junky ground, it just, okay, they were there.
Yeah. Well, unless we get an email from soccer that tells us that soccer's practice is canceled, we will maintain the schedule of lighting.
So it was on schedule for them to be there. You don't really know if they were there.
Well, I mean, they've always been very proactive in
okay.
telling me, at least, that it's canceled so I can turn the lights on or off. But essentially, we know the schedule for the whole season. We set the schedule for the whole season. So on any given day, if they need, you know, by the time soccer ends, they usually need 15 minutes extra for cleanup purposes. So the lights could be on till 8:30, 8:45, depending on the day.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you.
Mrs. Lieba?
So, a couple questions. Based on this, you're proposing this new rate for 2012.
The right-hand column, yes.
Are you getting rid of the non-borrow rates that we usually typically have?
Yes, there's three basic changes, really. The basic changes are that we get rid of non-borrow rates, and you know we've had that discussion.
So now, are all programs open to anyone? Doesn't matter where you live?
Correct.
All programs will be open? Okay. Then I don't mean to be a devil's advocate, but I notice that in most cases, you're dropping the rates compared to what we did this year in 2011. Well, most of the rates are less than 2011.
If you look at it from a point of view,
are you confident then? I don't want to, you know, I know you have lots of plans, and you need money obviously to do a lot of those things. So
we'll talk about that next month.
By doing this, though, aren't you going to be receiving in some ways less revenues? Or are you hoping because it's lower rates, you're going to get more people, hence more money to do the things you want to do?
Yes, exactly. The membership rates currently...
I just think, shouldn't you play it safe and keep the same rates as it was this year? Since you have made great strides this year,
The math that we did on let's take the pool membership, the general pool membership, which is currently $175 for borough residents and $250 for non. However, you have, off the top of my head, 80-some-odd borough residents and 40 non-borough residents. If you multiply those 80 by 175 and 40 by 250 and divide that number into 120, you get a number of about $166. I'm proposing $195. So there is a slight revenue increase. What you need more than anything else with the pool is more members. And this, what I describe as somewhat of a discrimination, you've said to people in surrounding towns, it's like going to Ace Hardware and paying $1.75 for a can of paint spray, but if you're from the borough, you pay $2.50. Trying to equate it so that everybody feels like they're members, participants on an equal basis through the program. Now, in Belvedere, for example, 70% of the people who belong to the Belvedere pool do not live in Belvedere. But those 70% help pay the Green Acres expenses that Belvedere has. You have exactly the same situation.
Well, Belvedere also has an agreement with Knowlton Township with the seniors, right?
No, not anymore. Yeah, we have this single rate program that eliminated all that early pay. Rates that, for example, in some of the sports you have programs where you get the second member of the family that's playing that particular sport is actually getting a reduced rate, whereas you need a rate situation that costs at least a 3 before you start doing it. I'd like to see a 3 and free. So there are reasons to equalize these things to make everybody feel that they're participating at the same level for the same service.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
I have a question.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, I like this the way you presented this ordinance in this tabular form here, but I'm curious why you didn't give us, and I know this is for the ordinance, but maybe you should have given us some sort of supplementary handout as to what the rates are to compare head to head, and an average with the non and resident rates put right in there, so you know, it's easy to see the difference. Otherwise, we have to ask you.
Yeah,
this year's rates, and then what other towns charge. You had mentioned you did, do some research in that way. I would be very interested in seeing what other, boroughs where these valleys charge for certain of these things. And then my other question and maybe you can answer this now, but was there discussion as to extending the hours of the pool at all to later at night to enhance the number of people that come instead of when you go there to see 5 people at night? Because most people that I understand that are residents here work elsewhere, and of course, by the time they commute home, it's 7:30 at night, the pool closes at 8, so maybe an extra hour. You know, was that discussed at all, or, I don't know where that's at with the committee yet.
We have discussed.
But part of that is we do have other things going on at night in the pool. We have swim lessons in the evenings for exactly that reason. We have swim lessons all week, and I think we have one session. We're probably considering adding another second session as well this coming summer because we did get a lot of positive feedback for that. But again, I think the main reason why we wouldn't want to extend it, into 9 o'clock hour or something along those lines is because there's just never been the traffic or even requests to do so from residents to be that late. It's pretty much always been a ghost town after 6 o'clock. I mean, that's just the reality. You look at your numbers and you track that over time, over the last year, the year before, and you look at how many people have signed in.
If you only stayed open until 8.
I'm just telling you what the numbers bear out.
Right, but as I'm saying, it's the commuter time, and of course, by the time people get home, pick up their kids, run down to the pool, they only have 15, 20 minutes. They say, you know what? Forget it. If they saw that it was an extra hour, they'd say, oh, you know what? Yeah, we have time now. All right, come on. Let's get changed. Let's get down there. Boom. They're at the pool.
There's no reason why we can't do that.
Okay.
You and I have talked about that.
Yeah.
The attendance is bad. There are things that we will change schedule-wise.
Okay.
Schedule-wise, things are not germane to what we're dealing with here. We need your authority to charge the rates. Staffing situations, for example, there are several things that after the first year's experience, I want to change those kind of things.
Okay. So getting back to the beginning part of my question, which was about the rates and about what we charge now. Can you just go down the list so I could just write them in?
Here, I have my answer.
Okay. And then if you could also input on what other towns, we're charging for some of these other things, so where do we stand?
Some of the stuff I can get you right away is Washington Township. Their website's pretty good with stuff like that. A lot of the other municipalities, the information on the website and from what's forwarded by their town clerks is very sporadic at best and very generic at best. Pool-wise, the rates a lot of times are heavily subsidized by the taxpayers. So that's sort of a little misleading in a sense when you see a reduced pool rate. You're like, well, how could they possibly charge that and still
heavily subsidized by the taxpayers within their budgets, which ours is not. So, yeah, I can give you whatever information.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see which municipalities do give subsidy to, you know, as opposed to...
Well, I know Hackettstown does for sure, but, you know, beyond that.
We just had a meeting last Wednesday, because they brought together the people, the administrator and, or the manager or the CPO of all the pools within the, in the county. So we're working on that exact thing from the horse's mouth, because as Victor says, you can't get it off the website. It's not always there tangible. But we're looking at those kind of numbers. One of the things which you have to look at, you can take, I'll throw out a number, $85 number for a soccer program in Washington Township. But they're not apples to apples, because they have a field fee separate from that. I've tried to work the field fee into it so it's a single number that the plan is collecting. So the coaches know what kind of number they're going to deal with. They don't have to worry about, I'm going to have to raise the money to pay for this or pay for maintenance because we're going to have two more games. There has to be some flexibility built into this program, and they have to have it up front. They have to know that they don't have to worry about that aspect of it, the ability to support the program based upon the people they have. And there may be programs where they don't get 152 people, they get 143. Well, at $55, that 10 people is going to change the numbers by $500 or $600. There will be flexibility in the program. It's not magic. It's something that we'll have to look at. We may be back right here next year doing the same thing, talking about adjusting some of the rates based upon what really occurs. When you have 25 fourth graders playing a particular sport and they move up in the following year, your teams change size, your number of coaches you need, the number of uniforms, those type of things are flexible within the program depending upon the turnout.
Right. I mean, to piggyback off of what Des is saying too, a lot of these types of things are cyclical in nature, where you have, at any given time, you might have 205-year-olds, but, you know, in subsequent years you have 25-year-olds. So certain programs that we cater towards smaller children may have great years and then may have lean years, so you have to be cognizant of that as well.
I have a question, a couple questions. You got these numbers based off of what was budgeted, and they were income and expenses?
Well, these numbers are all from the income that, let's take an example. Soccer had a number. They took in $6,800 last year, and they had 140 people playing, and they spent X number on uniforms, and they spent X number on league fees and whatever those things are in the budget, those category numbers. Because we're also going to include the cost of maintaining the field, in the case of soccer, for another 10 times $45. They've got an expense. I think the number comes out to, for the number of times that soccer needs the fields, comes out to about almost $1,000 difference. So when you divide that into the number, or put those numbers together and divide them by the number of participants in the sport, that's where you get the fee.
Okay. So this is coming, being self-sufficient from your trust balance?
Yes.
Can you tell us what you have in your balance? What you have in your trust account?
Do I know what it is right now? I don't know that.
Off the top of my head,
no.
But that is the target.
Be self-sustaining.
Yes.
Absolutely. So these fees were no contribution from the budget, from the borough.
Correct. The only things that are outside of the trust are the three things that were listed on the sheet that we gave you on the pool report, my salary, secretary's salary, and the one DPW employee. Am I correct? That's the numbers. And that was defined on that pie chart program we gave you about 4 weeks ago.
Okay, so my next question is then, if this becomes a commission, what effect does this have on that?
None. I mean, statutorily you need a fee ordinance in place in order to charge fees. This is what the fees the current committee's recommending, current director's recommending. Remember, once you set the min-max via the ordinance, you can change your fees 100 times throughout the year by way of resolution. What you see before you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Dennis and Victor, is this is what they're recommending the ordinance be amended to look like. Subsequent to that, if council approves, this could be introduced and amended, and then subsequent to that, they'll present you with their recommendations for the 2013 fee schedule. Excuse me, 2012 fee schedule, which could again be amended 100 times throughout the year.
Mayor, you did sit in on our last...
Some portion of it, yes.
And you see it was an interchange in the experience...
It was a spirited discussion.
I have a few questions. I agree with Torres that we should get some comparison of what the community doesn't have to kind of build sort of like that. You know, get, and kind of gather what their rates are so we can be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, we should be competitive for our local fees or sports and for the pool. I know it's not on here, and it might be a little off subject, but the refreshment stand, what kind of revenue are we taking from that? Is that looking positive? And obviously, you got prices are always changing on food, whatever beverages, but that's also an integral part of pool too, and revenue, and then taking things like, you know, making money.
Right, we gave you that on the concession numbers, we gave you that in that pie chart, and we doubled the receipts.
Okay.
We need to get it up to a lot higher, because the fixed operating, you still have to have a one person there.
Right.
In Belvedere, we generate three times that amount of money with the same staff. I hope to get there.
Right.
We might not get this to that level, but get to a level where that gets a great deal higher. And those numbers were in that presentation, that colored thing with the big circles.
Part of making that successful is some of the things we're doing here with the rates and the, you know, attracting the out-of-towners and then the later evening fees, which are so much less. Because, you know, you get people there, maybe they come at 6 o'clock after work and they haven't eaten yet.
Right.
You know, so maybe that's the incentive.
Yeah. The only other thing I can add to that is, I know when I was growing up, we had gone to Hackensack Pool, we didn't live in town, but they did some rates, I don't know if they were the same, work more for out-of-towners than they work for people who live in the town of Hackensack. So, I don't know, you know, again, I understand what you're saying, if we keep it quite equal, more people are probably going to be attracted to that. I understand what you're trying to say. Hopefully it does work, and that's what you can see a rise in the
One of the questions you asked about the membership, I went back through the 3 years for the pool membership, and in 2009, when things were going good, you had 133, combination of 97 and 36. Last year, with a bit of disaster, was 119 and 80 and 39, and that's before you did your refunds. Now that's, you got to pick through all that paperwork to find out how many of those actually got refunds. This year, we're at 149. With 102 in the borough and 47 not. So not only did we get over last year's problem, but we did better than 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think part of that had to do with the marketing campaign that we did early in the season, reaching out to the contiguous towns that may or may not have even known we still had a pool.
Any other questions?
The variable now on the second page. Does there have to be a dollar amount?
No, I hope not. We discussed that.
I'm sorry, what was your...
The variable number. It's in there three times.
Is it variable or does it have to have a dollar amount, he's asking?
Oh.
You see, the range...
No. I'm sorry. To answer your question, the right column... Excuse me. The right column, you need to remember, is what they're going to be recommending to you to approve via resolution. The problem with variable, and I think he was just going to allude to that, is the sports clinic for sport A might have a different need and a different expense than a sports clinic for event B. There's no one price that would work properly for every possible sports clinic that might work.
I think, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think basically what you're asking is the word variable okay as far as
yes,
the letter of the law, so to speak, as far as the ordinance goes.
I know it's
yes.
Between 100 and 1,000 there for special events.
When you word it in the resolution, it would be min and max is what the fees authorized to be charged would be, not a set amount. So
in
yes.
The, in the ordinance, not the resolution.
Well, no, it's, I apologize, in the resolution. The ordinance is correct, say, you know, 100 and 1,000, right. Min max. In the authorizing resolution setting next year's fees, the authorized amount for that project would be the min to max. So yes, it is correct. It is proper.
I've got one more question, and I hate to be going along kind of with the variable. You said the fees for the sports, such as soccer or softball, say it's $60 for ages 5, 6, and 7 for soccer. Does that include the lighting and the use of the fees?
Because of the fees, not the lighting. The lighting is a separate item on the menu.
So how is that coach supposed to figure out where are they going to get the money to pay for the field fee and the lighting if they have, say, 20 people at $60, right? That's $1,200. Where are they going to get the money then to pay for the field and lighting?
The field is already calculated as a number. The lighting only really affects soccer.
In nighttime practices.
You see, for example, softball has a choice because of the way the lighting and the time of day, daylight savings.
I understand that. I'm just wondering, how is the program going to get the money to pay for it if it's not in the user fee?
I want to keep the lighting issue separate because it only affects really one program.
No, I understand. I totally understand that. My question is, where are they going to get the money to pay for it?
They will probably suggest either they use a shorter schedule to get done before they need the lights, or they will come back to us and say, let's change the fee to a higher number.
All these programs will understand that user fee does not include a lighting.
They all clearly understand it.
If I may, Gene, just so you're aware, soccer, like many of the sports organizations, has created them a nonprofit organization for themselves, which raises money independently. That's where the fees would
be. They do a lot of fundraising.
Okay. They do their own fundraising.
I got one more question. When I was down at the pool, you were showing me the different lighting controls. Now, is that in the budget already? I mean, your particularly planned budget, not the one, of course, we didn't prove any yet, but I'm saying, is that in your plans to change the controls, and would the control factor in, you know, as to which lights to turn on at any particular time affect that soccer?
Thank you.
Okay.
For reminding me of that discussion. We've already talked to Musco. There are 8 towers. And the way it's controlled now, in essence, you turn on all 8 or you turn on 6, and that's your choices. I've already talked to Musco, and I've got a quote of something like $1,000, which is one of the things I'm going to propose that the borough fund that as one of the programs, because you'll save the money in less than a year. Because what I'd like to do, for example, soccer only needs 6 or maybe 5 of the towers when they go to work. So instead of turning on 8 by $7 an hour, they might turn on 5 by $7 an hour or 6 by $7 an hour. Anybody else who wants to use it, if a soccer clinic wanted to use them in the springtime, they may not need all 8, they may only need 6 of them, they may need 5. We'll have the flexibility to do that kind of thing. And it's workable. I've got the quote. We'll talk about it when we talk about budget time.
And the cool thing about the lights, let me just say this too, they're all hooked up through the internet too. So you can actually, certain people have access rights to go in, set the schedules, and turn the lights on, turn the lights off, change the schedules, and it's pretty good because it sets by dusk. So whenever dusk is, automatically calculates when dusk is, so you don't have to think about, well, when is dusk, you know, so then it's all taken care of for you. Worst case scenario, the lights are on, there's a thunderstorm, coach decides they want to cancel that particular practice, the lights are already on, coach calls me, coach calls Dez.
No, he calls you. Well, I can't
tell. Well, he called me.
He calls you.
I can go in on my phone and turn off the lights like that, or turn them on immediately. So there's a lot of flexibility there, and it really helps to build a relationship with the coaches, too, because there's that constant communication. So it's a side benefit.
It also creates responsibility because the report we get from Musco will tell us how many hours they were on and what days they were, and therefore we know what coaches are responsible for it.
Any other discussion on this?
One other question. Is there any reason why you do this now before budgeting, set these rates before you do the budget?
Well, at some point, we need to do it because there's sports happening all the time. And right now, we're into field hockey and youth basketball, and we're using the old rates, and we'll have to do that for what's happening here. If we wait till later, then we're months ahead, we're starting softball. So at some point, we've got to do it.
Well, this is just for the format for the ordinance to change the mins and maxes. The new rate for all is not necessarily what we're discussing. If we like the format, we'll go forward with that for that ordinance. The rates will be done by resolution.
Right, but we also broke some additional head start on the ordinance. Right, we broke some additional things out. We've added some different line items to give us more flexibility, specifically clinics, which, you know, run for a shorter duration, but they won't necessarily, we don't want to be pigeonholed into charging the same rate for soccer than we would for a soccer clinic that might be a week long. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's why some of the things are broken out as well. And we want to start introducing some additional clinics this year and next year as well, so that, you know, they wouldn't have been on the old format.
Any other discussion? And if it so be desired, I would accept a motion to create the ordinance setting the min and the max as recommended here.
Second.
Okay. Any other discussion?
You'll get the information like that for that.
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we can have that before we put it on the agenda for approval. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions?
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Cioni, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to suggest to them outside, please be my guest.
Well, it was also a related to the comment as well, about the road rules with the karate. I know that they use golden rule from Oxford, and I was just curious as to why the Washington Borough was.
Well, golden rule are residents of Washington Borough. Reports. We have the borough manager's reports.
Make a motion to receive and file.
Any discussion on that?
Mayor, I do real quickly.
Certainly.
Thank you. I've been looking at the recap item August 16th due to the Halloween weather. Tentatively, Rich, the stop signs, when do you think we could might get them installed?
It has to wait until after the ordinance, the 20-day waiting period
right.
after the ordinance is adopted. I would say, I'd say before the end of November.
Okay.
It should be that should be more than enough time based on when the ordinance is introduced, adopted, that
okay.
type thing.
Good.
I got
I'm
still on this.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want that one?
I thought you were done, Mr.
Brown. I got a few aspects. Real quickly, again, September 20th. I waiting for the name and the title of the railroad left that from the original letter I had asked.
Sure.
Okay, can you get that?
I'll email it to you, Tom.
All right, thanks. And my last one, October 18th, I'm not quite understanding Shade Tree's answer. I'm not challenging it with North Jackson Ave. Where would that have been on North Jackson Ave? You know, and was it near a house that had an address?
No, it wasn't.
It's in the back of 87. I was over there, I saw it.
You saw it?
Yeah. Where it was didn't have an address. That's where the tree was taken down. It didn't. It wasn't in front of a physical address where it was.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. I was just going to ask about
September 20th
about the railroad.
Okay. Mr. Torres, did you have something? Or?
No.
I thought I heard something from over there.
Nope.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Committee reports. Anything from the Code Book Committee?
Well, we'll be working on it for a while, but I'm just—I have it on the agenda to invite any council member who would like to attend a webinar. Because even after this year, they're working on updating, you know, our current like Code Book with the because it hasn't been done in a couple of years. Nothing to do with what we're working on. And once that's completed, Christine's always done with the review. That should be happening real soon, that's done. You know, putting in like the ordinances from 2009 and stuff. Once that's done, it's going to be available on our website. It's called E-Code. And so every ordinance now, anyone can go on and look up all the ordinances, you know, that we have. The committee is having like a little training, a webinar, for this whole E-Code with Christine. And I'm just extending an invitation to any other council member who might want to.
When would that training take place?
Oh, well, I need to schedule it. I wanted to know who else, who wanted to. It would be in the evening. Okay. I'll let you know.
It's not more than three.
What's that?
It's not more than three.
It can't be more than three?
Or we have to advertise. Then you have to have a quorum, public meeting and.
No, then maybe we can do that, because it might be a whole lot of people would be interested in it, so.
I don't see why it couldn't be open to the public.
Right, yeah, no reason it couldn't be.
Then you have to just work that out with Christine, because
right.
Public notice.
The only thing is that it'd be cramped in the council. We're just going to be looking, it's going to be online on a computer, so that's the only.
Maybe we could do it at the library or something else. Where
well, for that matter, if it's available over the web, you know, we could do it at home, too.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they, you know, they offer
it at
least
look through what we
on
have
on your
there.
Own.
Yeah.
You do it at home.
That's
if
what I mean.
If you're doing it as a group, even if you're in seven locations, it's still considered a public meeting.
Is it?
You can hook the laptop up to a projection screen if we have the equipment to do it.
I don't think we do. Well, I don't have a laptop.
Yeah, I have a laptop, but I can.
I don't think I have
a screen.
We have access.
Okay. Maybe after work. Definitely.
Okay. All right. So let's see. That's what we'll do. If I'll get a date for this, and if we have more than three, then I'll make it
like
public.
Christine,
now,
yeah.
Right. Okay. Great. That's all I have.
Okay. Old business takes us to Mr. Torres. Title search.
Yeah. If I could have. 10-minute recess, because I have a lot of material here. It's going to take some time to actually go over it, and I have to set up a table for a presentation. So, unfortunately, I hate to have to do this on a night when, you know, we're beleaguered with all these other presentations and everything else. However, this is something I, you know, feel is an urgent, you know, matter, so we should probably look at it right now.
So you're making a motion for a 10-minute recess?
Exactly.
Okay, is there a second?
Thank you.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Stop.
Okay.
Session. Mr. Torres, with your title search on roads.
Okay. Well, the whole reason this was brought to my attention was because this memorandum from our manager, which, you know, I was instructed basically, approved by the council to do this title search regarding, you know, the properties. In question here, which was especially the concern that Mr. Bill DeHaas had about his property. I guess it's number 77 North Jackson Avenue. Okay. In regard to that, the title search, of course, was quite extensive. It involved researching the title and any agreements between Conrail, which took over the Delaware Lackawanna Railroad, and the Morris Canal from previous owners. As I said, it's quite extensive. And the bottom line is, what I found out is the road in question, North Jackson Avenue, I found out, let me just refer to one map to start off with. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite all of council and any public that would like to follow in that to come down and view these maps, because the maps are crucial to this presentation.
Are you okay?
Oh, yeah. I can't.
I'm sorry.
Well, in this part, no. Okay, this is a map from June of 1924, and this is from our borough, you know, planning department. That the clerk, you know, gave me access to so that I can do, you know, my research here. It shows Jackson Avenue when it was originally called Jackson North Jackson Avenue with the part that actually went underneath the railroad elevation. Yes. Right now, the railroad, people that are not familiar with it, it's 18 feet above the, you know, rest of the ground surrounding on both sides. So at one time, this was filled in. right here. But this shows North Jackson Avenue, and it went straight across to Route 31, which at that time was Route 30, another time was called Route 69, I don't know. I have maps here going back. Let's see, the earliest one that shows the road in question and the parcels that are on the tax collector map in question are from 1868, which clearly show the roads where those parcels are actually part of an existing road, which the title search confirmed, you know, as I researched back, which was quite involved, just the title search part, because the parcels were distributed a long time ago in different parts. So in other words, one title conferred onto another property owner like four different or five different parcels within that one deed. Okay, so it got quite involved, but all the information is here, and the real confirmation comes in two important parts that I can refer to in the documents that you have in front of you in the handouts. If you look at a deed that's between, hold on one sec, Elizabeth Cattell in 1947 and Michael Kavich Jr., you'll notice in that it refers to an existing dirt road, okay, which is the road which always was a road since at least 1914 map, 1868 map, and it goes on down the line. But it's the largest on here, so of course this was done in 1924. Changes have occurred since then. It also, to give you a reference point, the property that Mr. DeHaas lives at is right where it says number 19 on this map right here. He lives in this, what used to be a barn, which was converted sometime, maybe 1970s or so, into a house, okay? This is his neighbor at number 79. Now, over the years, after discussion with Mr. DeHaas, I found out that not only has he had problems with the borough over the years for his egress and ingress and with his neighbors, but also with the post office, they actually made him change his address because there was no North Jackson Avenue. This was like, you know, a strange situation. Well, actually, I'm sorry, there was no rear of North Jackson Avenue. the other thing that the title search did find out, too, was that there's this piece of property here that sticks out and it runs behind these first four houses, is actually a foreclosed borough property. So the borough, according to the current county tax collector map and records, is borough-owned now due to a tax foreclosure at one time over these neighbors. Right now, that is grassed over, so it doesn't look like it's even a driveway or gravel anymore. This part here is the part on our tax collector map, which is divided into two sections. Even on this map, it says road, and that was whited out somehow. Okay? Further, the deeds also show reference to that existing roadway, and then they also show that the problem that of this particular road being railroad property. First of all, as I said, I researched a 90-page document of Conrail, which shows the conveyances, agreements, and easements that it has right-of-ways. And there was nothing in that particular document or in any borough document or in any county record that showed
any grantor or grantee or transfer of property ownership between the borough or an agreement between the borough and any railroad. Okay? So it's my contention that these two parcels always were a borough road. Okay? Now, if you actually go physically to the site, which I did do, what stuck out to me like a sore thumb was the fact that when you go there, you see this road. It looks like a road. As Mr. DeHaas had said previously, there's a manhole with a sewer easement underneath, obviously. And it was improved. There was, you know, at one time, probably at least 20 years ago, though, it was paved, but now there's gravel. But it's not kept up. But then his neighbor up the street has a down tree blocking the rest of what looks like a road, which is an existing road as well. It's a continuation of that same road. It's there that I decided that, you know what, this title search is actually searching the wrong property. Because I had our, of course, borough attorney, in discussions with him, forwarded me the documents of his title search 2 years ago of Mr. DeHaas's property, and it only looked at that particular property. It didn't research the needed neighbor's property. The key here is in the neighbor's property. At the corner, in what used to be a parcel that was owned by Elizabeth Cattell, which I showed you in that deed there, part of which was transferred to Michael Cabbage in 1966. But then after that, the current owner, Mr. Glenn, what's his last name?
Mayor.
Glenn Mayer. He decided to continue the development that was approved in 1966 of Cattell Court. Cattell Court actually is the other part of that back part of North Jackson Avenue. Now, these maps of the borough show there was discussion in 1961 of complying with the new statewide statutes for zoning, at which time they decided they'd make a master plan map, et cetera, et cetera. Also, during that time, every single tax map that we have in the borough was revised 5 or 6 times, 70s a couple of times, 80s a couple of times, I think 2000. Okay, and all those revisions went back to what I believe is a mistake on our 1961 borough tax collector map, which indicates this somehow as railroad-owned property, those two particular parcels that are in question. If anybody wants to come down now, I think it's a good time to come and look at these maps where I can actually point out the different, you know, parcels that are involved here. By the way, I do have a current planning board map from Suburban, done by our engineer, which shows that particular area as one extension of Cattell Court. Okay? So that it is right there. And this is relatively current, probably done in, you know, the last 4 years or so. You know, hard to tell. But if you look at the earlier maps...
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. This is Cattell Court right here.
Yes.
Coming around to North Jackson, and the blockage is right about...
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay? And you can see it probably better on the big map from 1924. Another interesting little tidbit on this particular site was that one planning board in probably a subdivision plan, which is referred to again in the title search in a deed, that it was the site plan was approved by the planning board in 1966, but checking all the back borough planning board records, okay, of minutes, it refers to approved minutes for a subdivision, and the following deed that Mr. Cabbage gives to Mr. Mayor shows that at any time that the borough decides to dedicate the road into becoming a borough road, because normally what happens in the case of a development, the borough can or may not decide to take up on the road as a borough road. It might leave it to the developer.
Can you say it was a borough road?
That's what I learned from doing this research. That's the bottom line. Right. But it was originally going to be planned to be called West Myrtle Avenue because it's directly across the Route 31 highway from Myrtle Avenue.
And that's the Cattell Court.
And that's Cattell Court, which the owner, Mr. Mayor, obviously thinks it's his property because he has signs all over the place, private road. He puts this gigantic tree blocking this borough road and no trespassing signs as well. And he's causing heartache for not only Mr. DeHaas, but everybody else on that, you know, back part of North Jackson Avenue. So, you know, it's something that, after talking to the attorney, he recommends, even though I did a very extensive title search, which would have cost at least $5,000 for an outside person to do, he suggested just to have backup for an actual title search company to continue to actually pursue a title search, but in this case, has nothing to do with Mr. DeHaas' property, but on Mr. Mayor's property, which is the property on the corner of Cattell Court, which owns the four houses that he rents out on the back parcel of that land that go around Cattell Court. That's what Mr. Cushing had recommended to me. The following is a procedure to change it. If we we don't have to dedicate the road to have it become a road either. In another handout, it kind of explains for everyone the choices that the borough has. Any municipality can either decide to dedicate a road, okay, or it can do nothing, and then it becomes a road, part of the borough, if improvements are made to it and it's maintained in any way. All right, and this is proved by that other handout that shows the court case that was very recent, you know, in regards to that.
So if I understand what you're telling me correctly here, you're saying that Cattell Court and North Jackson Avenue in that area are one road, essentially,
yes,
that was dedicated to the borough of Washington.
Actually, it wasn't. Dedicated means, it's a legal term that means that it's formally accepted by the borough from the developer.
Okay.
That's what a dedication is.
But it was offered to the borough of Washington.
Yes.
Borough of Washington never accepted the offer.
Well, there's nothing on record. That
right.
Doesn't mean anything. A lot of records are missing. It actually referred to the planning board meeting and minutes, forgive specific date, May 12, 1966, which there is none. We have no records. Our planning board minutes begin in 1967. So, you know, some of these things are non-existent. Don't forget, this is over 50 years ago, it's a long time ago, that this probable mistake was made. The other, after talking to engineers about this problem, it seems that this is a common occurrence sometimes in the cases where a parcel of land is in the corner of a top or a bottom part of a page of the municipal map. So in other words, if you look at our tax map, which
this little guy here,
okay, there's different zones where they, you know, have the different zoning on the key on the front, and then every section is divided into a different page. All right, now the county as well as the borough tax collector and assessors all use this information, and it's how the taxes are collected on any particular property, but they refer to the town. Okay, in which case, this also was a problem because not only was it on the border of a railroad, it was a border of the Morris Canal, which became a dry bed, of course, as we know after that, and which I have the maps going back to show that as well. And it's on the edge of the border of Mansfield and Mansfield Township and the borough of Washington. So engineers have explained that when it is on the top part of a page, it could easily be something that's a mistake, an error could arise on that particular case. It's very common, and it's not costly to change something like this. So what I'm saying is this whole street always was Cattell Court or North Jackson Avenue, whatever, after that subdivision was done and after that was paved over, because it was maintained by the borough. The borough did, you know, do improvements to it, have a sewer line under it. These are things that are proven by court to stand up and hold true, so that the property owner of that subdivision has no say in it if we decide to keep it. We could also, the alternative would be to vacate the road completely. Vacating a road means that legally you give up the right to have anything to do with that as a public road. It's not in the public interest, in other words. So we give up that road.
Don't you have to own the road before you can vacate it?
Yes.
Okay.
Where does eminent domain come in?
If it's something that's not the borough property and it's for the public good, the borough can use that legal term to annex the property and give compensation of fair value to the homeowner. So that's the way that works.
You say you've been in conversation with the attorney about this?
Yes.
Okay. I think I would like to get the attorney's opinion on Mr. Torres's assumptions here, which I don't mean to insult you by calling it that. I don't know what else to call
findings.
It, but it
is findings.
Findings. They're findings right now.
Thank
right.
you. I like that better.
Okay. Well, I mean, I have documented evidence. I want everybody to come down and look at, probably should look at all the maps, because the more you look at the maps and see, you can see easily that this was an existing road. It had nothing to do with the railroad until 1961 on the tax maps, when these two parcels, somebody didn't know where they went, maybe a surveyor, maybe an engineer. We don't know, but in any case, we'll never know, probably. It doesn't matter. The fact is, it was somehow became, apparently, according to the borough, railroad property. But according to the railroad, Rich, did you get any communication back from the railroad regarding any of these parcels?
Yes. What you're saying is contradicting what they're saying.
They're saying they own the property.
I never approached them about Cattell Court at all.
Okay, that's what I thought. And that's the whole...
Because they're...
That's the whole problem here.
No, let me finish, please. Their records indicate that they don't own Cattell Court, that they only own the dirt road leading towards Mr. DeHaas's property.
And do they have documentation to prove that they own it? Because I have documentation that proves that they don't own it.
Again, they told me on the phone... They have all the documentation that proves they own it, and again, our records indicate the same.
But your records only go back to the tax collector map, is that correct?
I think the only way to get a final answer is exactly what the attorney recommended, is paying an outside firm to give an independent review.
Right.
Of both properties.
An estimate that I got for that was $1,500, you know, give or take, depending upon who, you know, the title search company is that does this. Even though it is quite extensive, title search company would charge approximately that much, and an engineer would charge probably about an hour or an hour and a half's worth of time in an annual update that the tax assessor does every year to the tax map, where this can actually be corrected, if that's what, you know,
okay,
what everyone decides.
I think what we need to do is to get the attorney to look over all of this. Do it again when he's here at our next meeting.
Don't we have like a survey or something? Like, I'd like to see what the railroad company has. And
I have an air survey.
Well, the railroad company is under no legal obligation to come here, so we can ask, but I can't imagine they will.
Okay, Mr. DeHaas,
can't they
send
you a copy?
There's
again,
they're not legally required to provide us anything. I mean, our tax map, our parking lot information, our tax bills all reflect that specific parcel as being a railroad property.
Okay. Mr. Hoswick, you have something to answer?
Where's the documentation that the railroad says it's their property?
I don't have it. Again, it's on our tax map, our block and lot records, and our assessment records dictate that as a railroad-owned property. The tax...
I understand you showed me that tax thing. It took me 2 years to get that, but Where is the documentation that the railroad's claiming it's their property?
Never asked for it. All of our tax assessments, all of our tax assessment records indicate that it's a railroad property.
That's not true. That's only the records that are from our tax collection map.
No, no,
and our tax collector, when they computerized it, it's from the same period of time. That's what I'm trying to say.
We can sit here and debate this till tomorrow. The only way you're going to get a true answer is to pay an independent third party, as the attorney said two meetings ago, to do a full title search.
Well, yeah, that's what I had recommended. But however, I'm giving you the evidence right here. You can look for yourself. And I have documentation going back from the Civil War that this was a road that was the Borough Road. Nothing shows in any of the deeds, which I searched, and I not only did Mr. DeHaas's property, as I had said, which is superfluous to this question, it's really the next-door neighbor's property, which is the Mr. Mayor's property, which is at the corner of Cattell Court where that subdivision was. And those records are not maintained by the borough. There's no records of any planning board minutes that we have, you know, according to the clerk, and, you know, the wherever she checked in the planning board, they're non-existent from before that.
Well, planning board minutes wouldn't allow authorization to change a tax.
Exactly. So when I checked the council minutes for an approval, and I also checked the county tax records to find out whether or not this was ever a vacated road, it was never a vacated road either. So
it may have been a dedicated road that was never accepted by the borough.
Never officially accepted. But officially accepted means that it's filed legally with the county, as well as maintained and voted on by the council, of course. But, you know, that's officially dedicated versus, if you read the handout that I, you know, gave out, that refers to the current rulings by the judges on the law, which basically are saying that in a case like this, it's, you know, pretty much is going to be the borough's property.
This conversation doesn't need to be adversarial.
It's not adversarial.
What I would suggest is end the conversation, have council come up with funds. We'll look for funds, pay for a title search, and that's it.
Okay, very good.
We could spend the next day discussing this, but no one in this room is a qualified title search.
One more question, Rich. The names of the railroad people you were in contact with, do you know who they were? Or?
Alex Rocha and Charles Muir.
Did you guys get that? Have you guys done that?
I haven't gotten any.
Right. Because I was here, what, two weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago?
The one letter I asked Rich, he's going to get that for me tomorrow.
Oh, 2.5 weeks to get a name?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
If anybody else wants to come and take a look at these maps, now is probably a good time before we continue with the meeting so everybody knows what's what for. Yeah, it was Jackson Avenue, and then that part became, according to the maps, North Jackson Avenue.
If I may, just to clarify one statement made by Mr. DeHaas, implying that it's taken me 2.5 weeks to get information. In this form of government, no one council member has the legal authority to authorize me to do anything. The reference that you're making from 2.5 weeks ago was a statement made by Councilman Boyle. It was not motioned by any other member of this body, nor was it approved by any other member of this body. This body is well aware that they need to act as a body, not as an individual. So I take exception when you come to the microphone and imply that it's taken me 2.5 weeks to do something that I was not instructed to do.
So if I came to the podium last week and I asked you who it was, you wouldn't have told me either?
You didn't ask me who it was.
When you talked to Alex Rocha before, I've had Alex Rocha at my house, and you couldn't tell the audience here that Alex Rocha was one of the contacts you had?
That wasn't what was asked of me.
He asked who you were in contact with. I was here.
Actually, he asked if I could get him the information on who I spoke with. That was the question. This body is well aware they've been instructed. They've been instructed.
If I remember right, you might have said you didn't remember who you were in contact with. You would get that information to him.
Again, I'm letting you know what the law says. I'm letting you know what the attorney has advised this governing body in public session.
Yeah.
Okay,
let's move on.
Can you have audience questions here? Dave Higgins, 113 Harding Drive. I have a real quick question. Why don't we get the information from the railroad prior to spending $5,000?
They're under no legal obligation to give it to us.
All right.
We can ask.
Okay, have we asked?
So who's spending $5,000? I told you, title search, the attorney told me it was going to be $1,500, approximately. Right, not $5,000.
I'll make a motion that we request the manager to see if the railroad will give us their survey information or their proof that they own the property.
I'll second that motion.
Any other discussion on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions?
I think I make a motion to get the information right, as Rich spoke to, I know you said you're looking into it. We want to get a motion and the whole body to vote on that, so we'll have that problem next time.
I'll second it.
Rocco, whoever it is.
Yes. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Yes.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, Resolution 180.
Oh, I abstained on this.
Okay. Resolution 180, 2011.
So moved.
Aye.
Okay, is there any discussion on this? Hearing none, may I have a roll call, please?
Yes.
Boyle?
Yes.
Luther?
Yes.
Rule?
Yes.
Gray?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
Valentine?
Okay, how about if we do 181 and 182 together?
So moved.
Okay, is there any discussion on either of these?
Yeah, we need a resolution for the San Antonio and Washington Avenue?
No, it's not a resolution. It's not a resolution to install a center line. It's a resolution in support of the state's program on that. We're complying with this already.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, no, we're complying. This is a resolution in support.
Okay, any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? 183, 2011?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, is there any discussion? Roll call, please.
Valentine?
Yes.
Weaver?
Yes.
Rule?
Yes.
Corey?
Yes.
Donald?
Yes.
Dave?
Yes.
Boyle?
Yes. Just a quick question to move on here. Resolution 180-2011, seeing the address, 100 Bellevue Avenue, if you can afford to keep buying residents, I may have to abstain for that.
Okay. You want to change your vote to an abstain, just to be safe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No problem. We have on our desk tonight Resolution 184, 2011.
Make a motion.
Second.
Okay, is there any discussion on this? Hearing none, may I have a roll call, please?
Weaver?
Yes.
Valentine?
Yes.
Boyle?
Yes.
Dinger?
Yes.
Rule?
Yes.
Corey?
Yes.
Donald?
Yes. Okay. Vouchers. Okay, is there any discussion on any of the bills?
I have one question. It also concerns the last one we had. Going back to those computers that were purchased, there was no setup fees or anything that we were billed for?
No. It was all set up in-house. We didn't have to pay anyone to configure it to the network or set it up. I set it up in-house.
Who set it up in-house?
I did. I configured them all.
Oh, okay. Do you have an idea of, like, how much money we saved doing that?
The estimate that we got from a third-party company to come in was $3,800 to set them up.
Oh, very good.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Any others? Roll call, please.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I abstain on anything that has to do with
the
fire
department. Yes.
Corey?
Yes.
Valentine?
Yes.
Boyle?
Yes.
Very good.
Okay, that takes us to council remarks. I'm going to start off with myself. I received notification today from the New Jersey League of Municipalities that our three entries into the 2011 Innovation and Governance Award all received honorable mentions. We have the three certificates from them right here. Also, I had a call from a resident in regards to trick-or-treat hours. He suggested that rather than doing them from 4 to 7 on Saturday, that we do them like 2 to 4, 2 to 5, 3 to 6, something along those lines. I told them that I would bring it up in council and see if anybody wanted to think about it, or if we just want to keep it the same, being as that's what's already been advertised and is on the board.
Keep it the same. It's too hard to notify people.
Yeah, people are going to do what they want anyway.
And we had a mass notification system.
Perhaps we could keep in the back of our minds for the future, should there be something like this where there's a dangerous situation that we might consider when we, if we have to change the date, to change the hours to daytime hours. All right, that's all I have, Mrs. Lieber.
I don't have your number.
Yeah.
No, it came from a mother in the neighborhood.
Mrs. Lieber, any comments?
Just on this, the resolution authorizing executive session, it says like DPW garage litigation, so I thought we were having, are we having an executive session? Oh, okay. Because it wasn't checked, but then it was bolded down there, so.
It's there.
I didn't know. Okay, we're having that. I've got nothing.
Mr. Torres.
All I just wanted to say was, these maps, of course, are the ones that I have here are copies. I have photocopies of some maps that I got from the actually the archives down in Trenton, as well as the county clerk's office. But the other ones are probably the borough. I'm going to leave all the maps in the council office for any council people, in the board manager, to view at their leisure.
And thank you for your efforts, Mr. Torres. I forgot to say that earlier. Anything else, sir?
That's it.
Mr. Valentine.
Nothing. I just want to thank Rob for taking the effort to do that. It took a lot of work. I'm glad to see you did it. Even though I didn't really understand, and I just wouldn't do that, I could not make it.
Read the stuff and get it through.
I think that's going to be necessary for all of us.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Higgins.
Well, I would like to thank you, too, if I could, but I can't.
Okay.
Anyway, listen, Rich, do you think I could get the trust fund balance for the recreation department?
That's what council wants. Yes.
Can I step in and make a motion? Can you do that for a second?
That's what the attorney instructed us. He stood here and said the council has to act as a body. Yeah, so you have to do it.
But why are you making you make it? I'd like the balance of all the trust accounts.
So make the motion. And then
thank you. You can make that motion.
Wait.
Wait a minute. The clerk is confused.
All trust.
Right.
There you go.
Okay, any discussion on that? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions?
Okay, then my next question is, how does Banana Street get paid without the road department, without the streets department knowing about it and take a vote on it?
Because it was part of our routine operation when we do paving.
When do we pave?
When do we pave?
Yeah.
When we get the paver.
We have the paper, but my question is, listen, that road is paved from 57 down to the bottom. How much did that cost?
$4,600. Yes, 52 tons.
There's a lot more important roads that really need to be done, too.
The streets department should have known about that. If we're going to play by the rules, the streets department should have had, the street
committee
should have had some input on that.
Right.
So, might I understand that if I get a request for a pothole, I should not... I want clarification, and I'm not being sarcastic. No, I'm not. I'm being serious, because if I can't do my job... That's not my choice, David. That's not my choice. The attorney stood here and instructed the council on that.
You say, my door is open, you can come ask me any questions anytime.
Any questions?
We get into a meeting and
excuse me. Was an old member of council here?
If I would have went down there and asked you to find out what the trust fund account was, would you give it to me?
No.
No. Then why was the Highlands Council on the agenda for tonight?
Because every member of... Go ahead.
But that wasn't... How did that get on the agenda?
Because any member of council has the right to have something placed on the agenda.
We can't tell you what it is that we want on the agenda because that's individual.
The ordinances allow for any council member to place anything on the agenda, or any member of public for that matter.
I'm going to tell you this. If we want to
I thought you did the agenda.
I'm not playing games. I'm being serious.
Okay.
Anything else, Mr. Higgins?
That brings up a discussion that I think we need to do the manager's evaluation, don't we? It's been a year?
We were going to do that at the end of the year, were we not?
I thought we did it in October last year.
October's over.
If we're going to stay the course.
Okay. Anything else, sir?
Do I need to make a motion to have that put on the agenda for the next meeting, or what do I got to do?
I would say you would need to have, to make a motion to have everybody have their evaluations prepared by a certain date.
Okay, let's see, 14th would be an ideal, and how about,
The first meeting in December?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Can you send the form or whatever?
So moved. Mm-hmm. And then he has to be right?
Yeah.
Probably.
Okay.
Probably.
Then that's specific, right?
Okay, for the first meeting in December.
Sure.
Make that motion.
Okay, is there any other discussion on that? Do we have a second?
Yeah, he seconded.
Rob.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions. Anything else, Mr. Higgins?
No, thank you.
Mr. Jewell?
Thank you, Rob, for all the efforts in the title search. And John, I don't know if you realize there's keys for that office in the mailbox. I went to go pick my stuff up.
Oh, yeah.
I seen your stuff is gone, so I figured I'm going to start, but just so you don't forget, I forgot about you. I love you.
Anything else, Mr. Jewell?
That's it.
Okay.
I would say Halloween, watch out for the
children. Okay, no marriage proposals or anything? Sorry. Mr. Boyle?
I would follow that one. Thank you, Robert. Appreciate it. Nothing else, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay, then I would accept a motion for a resolution for executive session.
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
DPW litigation. Who seconded it, John?
Yeah, I moved it, yeah.
All right, second.
Okay. I heard a second. I didn't pay attention to who did it. Okay. Did we approve that? Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Good. Okay.
I think it needs a resolution number.
The one thing I didn't forget is the recap. Mr. Bell, give us your recap. Sorry, Justin.
Now close motion to contact my predecessor to back to see if he has any history on drainage issues on Harding Drive. The resident requested the pothole behind her home built. I have her address downstairs. Second resident requested investigation on some road repairs near Jefferson, as well as the bridge and or stream bank near Route 57 in Prosper. Introduction of the recreation fee ordinance amendment at the next meeting.
I thought we were going to get the information on that first.
Yeah. And we're going to discuss it.
Yeah, that's assuming that we have that information. I mean, we're not going to put it on the agenda if we don't have the information.
Well, yeah, if it doesn't get placed on the next agenda, it wouldn't be able to get introduced and adopted this year anyway. Timeline just wouldn't work.
So we got to have it quickly. I would say at the latest in our packets.
Oh, I would like to have it before that.
Yeah, the sooner the better.
So they don't forget what happened Monday week.
Right.
Yeah, make a motion for that?
Cattell Court.
We amended it.
That was discussed during the meeting. It was approved during the meeting. Cattell Court, North Jackson Avenue. I'm required to the railroad. Can you give me any information on their ownership and any of those roads there?
Touch base with Cushing as well, right?
That wasn't discussed.
All right. What do you think? What I did?
I hear the question.
Touch base with Cushing on that as well to verify my findings.
Wait, read back what you're doing.
Contact. The only motion was made to contact the railroad company to see if they have any information on their property ownership over there.
Yeah, but I'm saying to contact Cushing to verify my findings.
I'll second that.
I need all the information then.
Yeah, that's fine. So, like I said, it's going to be...
Second, any other discussion on it? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? All right.
Wait, abstention, one. Dave, you have to abstain on that.
We have to abstain. It's on the hot.
Hold on, let me just write that one down.
That's just to do the title search.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with actually.
No, this is not.
There's a different property. No.
There was no motion made to do the title search.
No. The motion was to contact the attorney regarding Cattell Court and North Jackson Avenue findings that Councilman Torres got.
Yeah.
So he'll have to abstain because of the North Jackson. Okay, one second here. Get the contact information for the railroad for the two gentlemen I've spoken with. I'll email that to council tomorrow. Get a balance of all the trust accounts. Rice noticed the manager for the November 1st meeting.
December.
Excuse me, December 1st. And now contact the attorney regarding Councilman Torres' findings. Do you have extra copies of all that so I can get it to him?
No, I'll go over with you before you leave tonight if you got a minute.
You want to take my copies?
Well, I need copies of everything to give to him.
I'll go over with you and I'll show you what probably is good to give him the most germane because, to overwhelm him with all these documents is just going to cost us money. That's unnecessary, so I don't think that's a good idea. So I'll just go over with you the documents that he would need.
Well, then if I may...
Do you want me to just assemble a package for him?
If I may, since you did all the research, maybe council would consider amending their motion to have Councilman Torres speak with the attorney directly in order to come up with a finding.
But I thought you already did speak with him.
I did, but I just wanted to verify.
Again, all I'm going to do is hand him that stuff.
Okay.
If that's what council wants, I can hand it to him and say, Dick, can you review and comment?
Yes.
Then I just need copies of everything.
You didn't have to give him all that information.
No, he doesn't have the actual title search that I did, so he doesn't have those.
Nobody can speak better to it than you since you did all the research, too.
Because all I would do is hand it to him.
So then let's amend that, so then I'll just give him the information this week, whatever.
Okay, everybody's agreeable to that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else, Mr. Paladin?
Nope, that's all I have.
Got the motion to adjourn.
Salute.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Adios, Missouri.